Powered from the Sereno Cigar Company studios in North Carolina and broadcasting from the Ventura Cigar Company studio in California, it's episode 99 of the Primetime Show. Tonight, it's industry panel discussion number 5 as we continue a 3-show series devoted to the IPCR pregame. We have Steve Saka of Dumbarton Tobacco and Trust, Skip Martin of Romacraft Tobacco, and Hector Alfonso Sr. of Espinosa Cigars. And as always, the Primetime Show is sponsored by Saga Cigars, makers of the Saga Golden Age cigar. The Golden Age is a cigar that takes you back to the classic days of cigar smoking. Through 6 generations of experience of the Reyes family, the Saga Golden Age delivers a timeless blend that uses the nobility of the tobacco to bring you the perfect balance of power and flavor. It narrates better than words the history of a family's tradition in tobacco, delivering a cigar much like the ones they used to smoke during the times of Hemingway. Saga Golden Age is a full-bodied, flavor banana and puro with tobaccos from one farm. The blend features a Corojo 2006 wrapper and filler from the original Cuban seeds grown in the Dominican Republic. Available in 4 sizes at an affordable price, Saga Golden Age is here to please and take you back on a journey to yesteryear. And Drew Estate, check out and download the Dribble Implement app for your mobile device. Keep up with everything going on Drew Estate. Experience the subculture that is the rebirth of cigars. Available on iTunes and Google Play. For more information, check out www.drewdiplomat.com. And by Dumbarton Tobacco and Trust. Master blender Steve Saka set out to create Puro Son Compromiso, cigars without compromise. This represents an expression of Saka's closely held values and attests in 3 simple words everything Saka wants to accomplish. Cigars are more than a passion for Saka. They are a way of life. As for the brands of Dumbarton Tobacco and Trust, Sobra Misa, Mi Querida, Umbagog, Muestra de Saka, Todos los Dias, and Sin Compromiso at your local tobacconist. Welcome, everybody, to Primetime, episode 99 for this Thursday, June 13th, 2019. It's Will Cooper here. I'm in the Sereno Cigar Company studios, joined by my co-host and friend, Mr. Alan Loomis. How's it going today?
I'm doing fantastic tonight, Will. How are you?
Well, I'm okay. I did have to put down one of my cars today after 16 and a half years. Yeah, I actually had passed it to my son. It was my convertible, but we had it for 16 and a half years. We were the only owners of that car. When I saw the car, I was very glad he was okay though, because it could have he was hit and run, unfortunately. But I knew, and the sad thing is he's on his way to Canada on vacation, and unless he's listening to the show, he doesn't have the official word of this yet. He may have just heard it. Yeah, I think he knew. Yeah, it wasn't no surprise.
Yeah,
but I mean, we have a lot of fun we're gonna have tonight here.
Yeah, I mean, if people tune in right from the start, they got a little behind the curtain.
I had to tell people we're gonna start the show.
Yep, but it was good. It's a good conversation.
I know. That's what we look for here today.
Yeah.
Without further ado, I'm going to welcome all these guys back to the Primetime Show. And I picked the order tonight so I don't get in trouble. First of all, from Dumbarton Tobacco and Trust, Steve Saka. From Romacraft Tobacco, Skip Martin. And from Espinosa Cigars, Hector Alfonso Sr. Gentlemen, welcome back to Primetime.
Thanks for having us, Coop.
Thank you guys for being on again for our 99th episode. And it's actually a year. Tomorrow is a year to the day since all 3 of you guys were on the show, which is kind of ironic that it worked out like that.
It only seems like yesterday.
It only seems like yesterday. But I'm going to try not to keep us as long tonight. I actually have been up since 4 in the morning for my day job. So fun stuff here. But let me ask you a question, guys. Are you excited? IPCPR 2 weeks. How excited are you guys, or not excited?
I'm on the plane coming back already, brother.
Come on, really?
I am. I just am. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's going to be nice to go see them and see you guys. But I'm on the plane headed back already. You know, we've done this before. You know that I hate, you know, I hate the travel. I hate being in Vegas. It's hot as hell. It's not fat boy friendly. It's tough, man. It's a tough place to be for me.
You get sick coming back, right?
What happened?
You get sick coming out of the dry weather, going back to the humidity?
No. Knock on wood. Knock on wood, that hasn't happened. I get usually more sick coming back from Nicaragua. And this last time, I was just there. I'm fine. I mean, I had some stomach issues, but I can't blame that on Nicaragua. So, right. But no, I just – it's that – that next day when we come back on the red eye, we're zombies. Absolutely. Rob's a little zombie that next day.
Yeah, I've learned I used to do the red eye all the time. I'm done with it now. I just can't do it anymore.
I was super excited, and then Steve Sakka started to chip away at my childlike illusions with it, with his jaded negativity.
Oh yeah, blame me. You're the one that messed me out. Listen, I've been going to this trade show since 1994. So the bloom is long off the rose for me. You know, it's basically it's work, and it's something that needs to be done, and I approach it like any other task. In fact, I think most of these guys will tell you they never ever really ever see me out of my booth, because I mean, I've walked around the show so many times over the last, good God, it's been over two decades. So I'm there, I work, I do my thing. I don't do much at night, you know, I make a few little cursory appearances, and but for the most part, I treat it as a work week, and it's, you know, it's a hard work week for everybody. It's exhausting leading up the show, it's exhausting at the show, and it's exhausting after the show. So it's always a really, it's a tough go for, I think, everybody in the industry, whether you're big or you're small. The only time it's a little better is when you're like the big cheese at a big company, then you just kind of swoop in and smile and eat fancy meals, and then you get to swoop away. But for the people that actually have to work for a living, tough job.
I can hear you on that. Let me ask a question. You know, the first thing is, there's always drama with the trade show, right? And this year's no exception. The drama about the trade show being before 4th of July, overrated or underrated, guys?
I mean, for me personally, it doesn't matter, but I think it's going to affect the number of people who attend. I hope it doesn't, but for me, like, you know, the date doesn't really matter, but I think it's gonna affect how many retailers show up.
I mean, for the most part in our business, that weekend before, the week before the 4th of July, is one of the best days in one of the best weeks in most retail shops. So it is an extra burden on the retailers themselves. There's no doubt about it. You know, because other than, you know, Southern California, Arizona, Florida, for most of the country, that's when they're really banging. And so it definitely puts a bit of undue pressure. And look, I don't think the IPCPR, which is comprised of a board of directors made by retailers, I don't think they're oblivious to this fact. I think they really wanted to get us back in the sands. I really do believe them that this was the time frame that was available to them, because I don't think they wanted it. They knew it sucked from jump, but they also thought that in the long run, getting back in at the sands would be better for the convention overall than us staying at the Las Vegas Convention Center.
Like you said, the date doesn't matter. We got to go anyway. We're going to have to go to the convention. We're still committed to going to the convention. It's going to be, you know, it's going to look like the Titanic when people are trying to get out of there that last day. Everybody's going to try to get out of there on the second, because the, you know, July 4th is an awful travel day. And I've already heard some people say they're staying and leaving on the third, which is crazy. We're getting out of there as soon as we possibly can on the second to avoid any travel rush. So,
well, I've heard
concerned about that, but
as we've started making the appointments, a lot of people have said they want to make an appointment on one of the first 2 days because they're leaving on day three. Yeah, so they're actually leaving on Monday.
That's the exact same thing for me. Our appointments are really booked solid Saturday, Sunday. And then Monday, I think maybe only half of them are booked. And then Tuesday, I don't know that we have more than maybe four or five appointments scheduled at this point.
Yeah, so maybe I think I think it's going to be kind of a ghost town Monday, and then it's going to be like a graveyard on Tuesday. So,
which is what happened last year. There was this drop. I saw it Monday afternoon happen, or day three it happened, where there was a drop. It was very noticeable.
Yeah, the problem with that is, you know, really 2 days is not enough time for the retailer to do the show. I mean, you really genuinely do need a minimum of 3 days to hit the number of booths. I understand why they do it, because they're looking at it as, okay, I fly out on a Friday and I return on a Monday. I only lose two essential, you know, three work days, four work days at most. Whereas normally when they started on a Monday and you fly in on a Sunday, they then lose an entire work week. So I understand why retailers do it. They're trying to do the same thing we all are trying to do. We're all trying to be very judicious with our time because there's never enough of it. But ultimately, I don't know that it does this show well, this Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday kind of schedule. I think it almost sets it up to be really a 2.5 day show instead of a 3.5 day show.
I agree with that. Do you guys, I mean, I've heard, you guys have all been involved in retail at one point or another. Do you think that this whole thing about 4th of July being one of the biggest retail holidays, is that true or false? Because I would think Father's Day 2 weeks beforehand is a bigger retail holiday. Maybe I'm wrong on that.
From my experience, when I worked at a shop, July 4th was crazy. We actually had extended hours. Okay. We actually opened up early because, we have good weather here most of the year, but we'd open up early just because you got those guys who want to come by and pick up that bundle or that half a box of cigars because they're going to hit the boat. They're going to go out to Elliott Key. They're going to go, you know, they're going to go do something for the weekend. So, we did see an increase July 4th, but, you know, Father's Day is a big deal as well.
Yep. Very true.
It's a general rule, though, William, that gift giving of cigars has decreased dramatically over the years. I mean, the retailers used to see a much bigger bump during the Christmas holiday, Father's Day, those days, and it's not as much as it used to be. I mean, they still sell cigars, but a lot of those are guys buying their own gifts for themselves. You don't get as many, hey, I want to go in and buy my dad a box of cigars for Father's Day in this decade as you did 2 and 3 decades ago. So that overall gift buying has decreased tremendously for a lot of retailers.
Fair enough. So we're talking about drama. Let's kind of kick it off with some drama here. The big word on the street, and I think it's no secret. It's already been talked about on several shows. There is this looming change in the trade show coming or being proposed for next year of having a consumer element to it. Have you guys heard that story, or am I breaking it to you guys for the first time?
I've heard the rumor.
Yeah, I don't think it's a rumor. I don't think it's a rumor. It's already been discussed.
We heard you talking about it last week when we were in Nicaragua.
Yep, and it's been discussed on other shows already as well. That this is supposedly coming next year.
But wait a minute. If it's supposedly, how's it not a rumor? Is it a rumor or is it not a rumor?
Well, if it's on Coop's show, it's not a rumor.
These are free.
Okay, I'm going to say I've talked to enough people and been privy to enough information to say it's got legs. And I'm just going to keep my sources undefined here.
I heard from somebody who's pretty in that said it was that it's definitely been decided. But I think once they announce it and they start getting all the feedback, I think it'll change a lot.
So let's talk about that part, Skip, for a minute. Is there any way you announce this before the trade show, or do you wait till after the trade show? I think it's suicide if they announce this before the trade show. I think they're setting themselves up for failure with that.
I mean, I agree with what you said that I agree with what you said in your last show, which is don't announce anything negative before the show that's going to take away from
buying. Yeah.
Right.
The thing is, you're assuming it's a negative, and I'm willing to – I want to hear the details. I want to hear what their proposal is. I want to understand what they're trying to accomplish, how they figure they're going to fit it into the schedule, what's going to be the responsibility of the manufacturers. I mean, you know, in a vacuum, I'm thinking about it. Look, my booth, I don't think any of our booths are really set up for consumer interaction. I mean, it's hard to imagine a big smoke-style environment running through that trade show floor. I mean, we have enough difficulty with a few retailers not being sticky fingered. I don't know how we could ever control consumers en masse. But I'm willing to suspend judgment until I hear the details. And look, and again, look, I'm very critical of the IPCPR, but I'm not critical just to be critical. I know that they're trying to figure out a way to make this trade show have a long-term future. That's what they're trying to do. Whether they're going to be successful or not, I don't know. But I do feel as though they feel like, hey, we need to throw some stuff at the wall and see if we can get anything to stick. Because, I mean, the trajectory that we've been on, it's not a sustainable one. And I don't think it's an IPCPR problem. I think it's just a trade show convention problem in general. So I don't think they've been doing a bad job of things. I think it's just the nature of all business today. We've all just kind of, you know, trade shows aren't as critical as they used to be.
Well, you wouldn't think so by the price tag.
Well, look, that's part of the equation, Skip. You look at the CBA of it, the cost benefit analysis, and look, it's hard. You know, I know when I was a Drew, we were $500,000 plus a year. And I'm sure it's escalated considerably since I've left. And I know that even for my podunky little company, I'm out $75K cash, you know, just actual direct real expenses, not time, you know, not, you know, discounts, but just real hard cash. And you know how many cigars I have to sell to make $75K in profit? It's a lot, you know, particularly given the scale of our company. So it's a tough scenario. And I mean, and this is the problem that we're all struggling with. The retailers are struggling with the cost to go. We're struggling with the cost to go. Everybody is trying to figure it out. But at the same time, in my heart, I think having some sort of annual trade show is important because it's one of the few times where we are all together under one roof. We are all in the industry. That common experience helps make – part of what makes our business so appealing is the fact that even though you're my competitor, Hector's my competitor, the schmucks over at such and such are my competitor, it's nice to be all in one place. You know what I mean? It does make our industry united to a degree. And that shared experience, even if the shared experience is bitching about how bad the IPCPR is, at least we all enjoy that together. You know what I mean? So I think there's an element for it. I think the question is how to make it work going forward. That's the challenge. And look, it's not an easy task. I mean, I've thrown out some proposals, some other people throw out some proposals, but ultimately, I don't think there's a magic bullet.
Well, what you're saying is true from the industry side, but I mean, going back to the question about the consumer side, you know, my first trade show, I was 25 years old. It was like 1996, 1997 in Nashville in Opryland. The trade show floor pretty much kind of had evolved to the point where it looks like what it looks like now with the big booths and everything. They weren't as elaborate, I don't think, on the average. The smaller guys especially didn't put as much into it. But I remember walking in that door, like, and it was like walking into the, you know, Charlie's Chocolate Factory. I mean, for me as a consumer, and just walking around and seeing, you know, Tony Barani and, you know, Carlito Fuente and, you know, all the guys because events weren't as common back then. So, you would read about these guys in Cigar Aficionado, or you didn't have shows like this. You didn't have those guys come into your stores that often. So it was a crazy experience. And I only also had kind of the experience of my retail shop. So when I saw all these different things that were available, it was an amazing thing for me. So I can absolutely relate to why a consumer, even if it's not a, you know, trick or treat giveaway cigar thing, you know, when you come to the Nicaraguan Cigar Festival, they give you a commemorative box of cigars, right? That has two cigars from each factory that participates in the chamber. You know, if they did something like that, where it was like a nice little box where you got 5 or 10 cigars at the door, and then when you came in, all you really were there to do was just to kind of look at the products from an expo perspective, shake hands, get people to sign boxes, you know, go back, David Ortiz is signing your box, or one of the superstar basketball legends and you're shooting hoops with them or whatever, right? Like, I could completely relate to how that would be a good thing for the industry, especially if it was raising money for the IPSPR. And as we already talked about, to me, the best day to do that would be the last, you know, the half day, the last half day, because the booths are already set up. People are already there. Sales, a lot of the salespeople can go home. If you give the media guys entry to the floor the day before the show begins so they could take all their pictures and do all that stuff, then it kind of evens that out where it becomes more of an expo. There's an expo component to the show in addition to the trade show and convention aspect of it. If you threw in, you know, a nighttime thing for consumers, if you threw in seminars in the second half of that day where they could, you know, do rolling seminars like they do with the Big Smoke, or they could do Q&As with panels or whatever, I think it would be a great thing. But I, from what I've been hearing, I don't know that it's been thought out that well. I think everybody's thinking of it in terms of what you're saying, which is let everybody in before the show starts or something, have them go around trick-or-treating for cigars and then kick them out so that the show can start. And
yeah, but part of the problem with that too is, look, I mean, we have tax implications in Nevada.
So right.
That means that we end up having to pay taxes on those cigars in order to give them away. So that's got to be worked out. I mean, the thing about the last half day of this show, I mean, the problem for that is, I mean, we're all beat to shit. Do you really want to interact with thousands of consumers after you've gone through? Because I don't know about you, Skip. Well, actually, I do. We're all pretty much the same. Like, I'm flying to Vegas on Tuesday because I have an 8 a.m. mandatory move-in on Wednesday. I physically have to be there to sign for the stuff. So the trade show, even though it's only 3.5 physical days, for me, it turns into a 10-day trip. And the idea of, you know, trying to interact with consumers after the 9 days, I got to admit, that's going to be a tough gruel. I mean, maybe you'll get a little pumped up because they're there and you'll put on a smile and you'll just kind of ride the wave. But I don't know, man. That part concerns me a bit. Like I said, I want to hear the proposal, and I want to hear what their perspective is on it. And am I willing to try it? Heck, I'm willing to try it. You know what I mean? The worst comes to worst, I'll say, wow, this sucks, and I'll choose not to do it in the future.
You know, Steve was saying earlier that how the shine has come off the diamond for us a little bit. Yeah, I think that having consumers there would, you know, that also, as Skip said, the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I remember my first IPCPR, walked in, I was like, wow, look at this. And I think the consumers would really enjoy that outside of the trick-or-treating part. But like we've already talked about here, it's difficult enough having a customer day. Now with the state of Nevada, which we still haven't been told what to do with that second form they sent us with the licensing agreement, because that's the first person. I called Nevada. They didn't answer me. And I called Christine, and she said they were working on it. But now we have to worry about Nevada getting a hard on thinking they're missing tax dollars. And what's going to happen if you get consumers in there? It's going to be tantamount to having these large groups, these pep rallies, moving pep rallies between his booth and Skip's booth and coming to our booth. It's going to be incredible. Since we all own a little piece of each other's customer base, they're just going to be floating around. But will we get any business done? Is the goal to get business done? Is the goal just to shake hands and be friendly? Hell, we already do that in November. You know, we have 120, 130 people come to the warehouse in November. I don't know if it would be good. And then I didn't even think about what you guys were saying, keeping eyes on things. Because, yeah, we all of us have great fans. Our fan base, I think, is great. Your fan base and Skip's, the guys who love our cigars and love the guy who love air, they're super committed to us. And, you know, but there's always a bad apple. And what's going to happen? You know, these guys don't come to these events. They might get rowdy. Next thing you know, there's liquor. I could see the positive spin, but I can see there could be a negative, you know, there could be a negative connotation to this. The tax part really scares the hell out of us, because I don't know about you two guys, but we don't know about that second form yet. Have you gotten some elaboration on that?
Yeah, Yeah, we filled all that out. They said it was due like a month ago, so we already filled all that out.
No. We got our temporary. We got our temporary licensing in the. I got an email today with my temporary license.
Right, but attached that email. Today. I got my letter with a temporary license. You got
to. I'm sorry, it was yesterday, but attached to that, there was a tax one. Right. So the question is, are we selling? We're not selling cigars. We're giving away cigars. Are we going to be taxed on the cigars we're giving away?
According to Christine Morgan, when I spoke with her, is the question is, are we as manufacturers supposed to fill out the form with a zero value and submit it, or can we just waive doing the form at all?
Hey guys, for our audience, what are we referring to here, just so our audience can understand this?
This year, the state of Nevada required all of us to get temporary OTP license in the state in order to distribute.
Interesting.
So we all had to file the paperwork in order to get it. And in addition to that, we had to file a list of the cigars that we believe that we are going to be bringing to the trade show to allow them to audit what we actually bring. And the requirement was for that the state would then in turn have to issue a letter to each of the individual manufacturers saying that they had that their OTP license was approved. I received my letter yesterday. I guess Hector received his letter yesterday saying we're approved. But in addition to receiving the letter, we also received a tax form that requires to be submitted by August 25th. Okay. And the thing about it is we were told in the beginning that this was a formality and that there would not be any actual taxes collected because it's not really a selling show. You're not actually committing sales at the IPCPR. What you're doing is you're taking orders. So now we have this tax form, which is another step. And look, we're always very nervous in our business about anything to do with taxes and governments because they always seem to be another layer to these onions as you peel them back. And none of us want to establish a nexus in the state of Nevada, nor do any of us want to get hit with an unexpected cost because you distribute quite a few samples at the trade show. It's another tremendous expense if you end up having to pay those taxes. So the question is, it was the fact that these additional tax form accompanied the OTP license with the mandatory requirement data fulfilling it is the part that's got everybody wondering. The IPCPR says they're going to give us direction on this. They do not believe that any of us should owe taxes. They just don't know the answer as to whether we are going to have to file the form with a zero amount on it or whether they're going to waive us all filing the forms. I find it hard to believe that they're going to waive us filing the forms because why would they have sent us the form? Why would they have made us get an OTP license temporarily in the state? So it's kind of marching down this incremental pathway that seems like, oh gosh, the state of Nevada is going to start collecting taxes when we do a trade show here.
I didn't go to TP, but I'm wondering if this happened for the guys who went to TP, and if it did happen to TP, it would have been nice for them to let somebody in, you know, our side of the business know, you know?
Yeah, but I think it's kind of bullshit if some manufacturer saying, oh, the $1,100 or $1,200 tax bill is going to, that's the game. That's what made the decision for me. I don't give a shit. Give me a $2,000 tax bill. Like, I think they charge us that just to use the bathrooms for 3 days.
For the record, Skip's going to pay my taxes. Thank you.
$2.
I don't care about the $2,000. What I'm concerned about.
Money. The issue, Skip, is you're establishing nexus for tax.
There's that.
Which has long-term ramifications from a corporate tax perspective. And that's
do I owe franchise tax in Nevada? Do I owe so there's that. But what was interesting to me was when they originally sent all this to us, they said, we need to know exactly what you're displaying and we need to know exactly how many of what cigars and how many you're gonna give away. And I'm like, I don't even know that necessarily. So we took our best guess and filled out, here's all the things we're going to have on display. Here's how many cigars we're going to give away. Now, if some, you know, guy in a fucking cousin of somebody with a cowboy hat walks in and says, oh, let me see all your cigars. Oh, we're confiscating everything. Or you know, that's what I'm concerned. Like, I don't like new rules because I'm the kind of guy who likes to be compliant with rules. But I don't like new rules I don't understand.
I don't like new rules 2 weeks before the show or three, right, and not having the clarity. And I'm not gonna blame her, obviously, because they're probably also not getting their calls returned on time. But 2 weeks before the show, and this is a huge question mark. $2,000 is not gonna stop us from going to the show. Hell, that's not gonna stop. But still, it's nice to know what expenses we have forthcoming. And you know, and it's going to suck to get hit with a, if we don't comply the right way, or if we're given the wrong information and we receive and we don't comply by the August 25th rule, or the date of August 25th, we comply incorrectly. We don't need that problem, because where's the show next year?
Yeah, or let's say they send some dupe customer into the trade show floor, and somehow they get in, and we don't check their badge, and they turn out to be a consumer, not a retailer, and all of a sudden now, you know, you're caught up in a vice sting or something. It's like, I got too many other fucking things to worry about. You know what I mean?
Are they charging you guys for an OTP temporary license?
I don't think so.
No, we didn't get charged. It was free.
So they're actually, but they're making you get the license anyway. I wonder if that's.
But why? It seems like an unnecessary layer of governmental interference, and this is coming from a government employee. It just seems like an unnecessary level. If you're not collecting any money, why do you need to license these people?
Well, I understand it as a concept, Hector. They're saying we have this rule in our state that if you have tobacco interactions, you have to have permitting. So by not requiring you guys to do it, we're creating this exception that everybody else can point to and say, well, how do they get away with not doing it, right? So I understand if you have a rule, you have a rule. But what doesn't make sense is it seems like easier to me for them just to pass some kind of exception into the rule that says for trade shows and conventions or whatever, right? But I'm sure when TPE comes into town and they're giving away, you know, they're importing 5,000 packs of cigarettes, that they want to sell those cigarettes. They don't want to unstamp cigarettes or whatever, right? So I don't know.
It would be nice just to have a little more clarity, especially with in the home stretch. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
that's all.
So I got a few questions back to cigars and the consumer day. And it's maybe a little related to what we just talked about, the first question. If let's say next year there's a consumer day, are you guys giving out the new cigars that you have out? Or are you giving out?
We might not be allowed to give out cigars. That's what we're trying to say. We don't know, you know.
But if they're going to have consumers, there'll probably be a cigar component, okay?
I'm not giving away any cigars for any reason.
Yeah, that's my question. Are they going to base – you're not giving cigars away for any reason, right?
I'm not.
Okay. So that's a big question. I mean, how many people – I mean, you have 100-something booths, or 100-something people going to contribute, you know, and what does that mean?
If you got 300 consumers coming, maybe I'll give away 300 T-shirts or 300 –
swag maybe, you know.
I'm not giving away 300 cigars.
Okay. Let's take that out of the equation. Let's say people are going to give away cigars. Do you think consumers are going to want to come in and get a cigar that's been on the market 5 years, or they're coming to this big event, which is kind of the industry Super Bowl, and it's all the what's new? They want to walk out with the what's new product. And my theory is the expectation of the consumer is going to be the latter. And if they go with the former, it's going to disappoint the consumer.
I think a consumer who's paying an airline flight to go to Vegas,
he's going to
want more than one cigar.
Let me say this.
And I think he might be disappointed with anything he gets anyway. I mean, who knows?
Look, I have a totally different take on it. If it is part of the doing this show, we'll do it in a way that I always want the customers to be happy. And ultimately, if a guy is willing to come to Vegas, and this has always been my feeling about, look, this is my feeling about you, Coop, when you wanted to go to the show. You know, if somebody's willing to spend their own money to come to the show and to cover it, and, you know, they go out of their way to lose 4 or 5 days of work, or they take vacation time to do it. I mean, they're some of your best advocates. So for me, look, I want to hear the details, but if I have the opportunity and I'm in front of X number of consumers and it's fiscally possible, then yeah, I'll try to put the best foot forward for those consumers that come. I want them to have a good experience at the Dumbarton Tobacco and Trust booth. And I know Skip does too. He's just being a little obstinate right now. But Stu, look, we all know that we can't give away cigars. There's going to have to be some sort of pay component. The FDA element doesn't allow us to give cigars to consumers without some sort of transaction. And what if that transaction, that money all goes into the IPCPR legislative coffer? Well, then, you know, the money they collect there just means it's money that they're not charging us in a different way. You know, so there may be some, I mean, if this show can raise X number of tens of thousands of dollars that end up going towards legal fees and lobbying efforts, then I think most of us would agree that's a positive thing. So again, devil is always in the details. And until I know what it is, to me, everything else is just speculation.
We are speculating. There may be a cigar, or a big smoke component to it. Who knows? If there's a big smoke component where people have to buy a ticket to go in, well, then maybe you can cover the concern that the state of Nevada might have, and as Steve is saying, that money collected can be put for the IPPR can use it for its legal, you know, for what it's doing to try to help us with the FDA. But we've got to have everything. I mean, we're just speculating now, but it'd be nice to know. I guess we have to wait till Monday.
Okay, let me ask another question just related along these lines, though, to Consumer Day. Who mans these booths? Are reps going to be the guys to basically man these booths? Or my feeling, again, is that consumers are expecting the brand owner. I know you guys are smaller companies, but when you get into some of these bigger companies, I think the expectation is people are going to be meeting these larger brand owners here, not reps.
Yeah, and I think that if there is a Consumer Day and it's at the end, each company will make the decision of whether it's important for the principal to stay.
Oh,
in the case of all three of our booths, the principals are there all the way from the beginning to the end. It's only the very largest, look, I'm speculating because I'm not in their booths, but you're talking about the Henke Kellners of the world, you know what I mean? That might be there and then leave on the last day, you know? So for the most part, I think most companies are just, they're going to make a decision. And look, there's some people that consumers want to interact with. And there's other people where, honestly, I mean, who do you want to meet at General? Do you really care who the president of General Cigar is? No. You want to meet the faces of the brand, you know, the Sean Williams of the world and the Ricky.
Right, right.
So for them, that'll be the guy. Because they don't really care who the CEO is of General Cigar.
No, and I was taking more of the bigger personality names, the people who we know.
In our booth, they're going to want to come and see Eric. In Steve's booth, they're going to probably want to see Cindy. But, you know, and they're going to want to see Skip and Rosales, or probably Danny Vasquez, who's big now, you know. So, I mean, yeah, they're going to want to see. It would be disappointing if there's a pay component to it and they get there and, you know, they got to see me. If they got to see me, they're going to get their money back. I mean, that's nobody the hell wants to see me.
I still think one of the biggest things for this is how they sell it to the retailers, because any amount of consumers that are coming in and getting cigars is cigars that are not being bought from the retailers. So
except for the retailer who brings his best friend who calls him the cigar sampler. I'm the official cigar tester of Joe Blow's cigar store.
That's true.
That's my favorite guy.
Most retailers do. I mean, I would say probably 50% of the retailers do have a little bit of an entourage with them.
I need six samples of that.
This isn't a new thing. This has always been the case ever since the cigar boom. Look, I went as a consumer those years, you know, 94, 95, 96, 97, 98. I mean, my first official gig, I mean, look, they didn't recognize me bloggers when I started. So I was way under the radar. So, I mean, the first time I was legally at the trade show floor was probably 2000, but I mean, honestly, again, I go back to when you have someone that's that cigar crazy, they're almost always really good advocates for our industry. They come back from the show. They're excited. They tell people about the cigars they saw. They tell people about the cigars they're excited to smoke. This is just not something I'm going to get my panties in a twist over. And when it comes to giving samples to consumers or to the friends of retailers, the cigar sampler taster, if I don't want to give it to them, I can fucking say no. I'm a big boy. I'm capable of telling someone no. You can't have a sample.
I've been saying that for years that we're still in the bylaws. There's bylaws in the media that we're not allowed to ask for samples. And
honestly,
still in there.
I bring it up, Coop, but it's such a stupid talking point because honestly, they want you to try the cigar. Same thing. Yeah. I already treat the show almost as an expo. I do very little selling during the show. In fact, I'm booked so solid with media appointments. I think I have like 6 media appointments every single day, except the last day in which I have like 4.
And I'm one of those four. I always go the last day.
So, I mean, like I look at the show as an opportunity to spread the gospel, to tell what's new, to tell consumers about the brands. I don't look at it just as a selling show. I look at it as an opportunity to take advantage of the fact that you are all there and you all have your own individual audiences. And I want to convey my message and you guys afford me the opportunity to do it, and I in turn afford try to provide time to allow that to happen. It's a mutually beneficial relationship, and I think you know, I've always been that way, and I know these other guys probably have been so. Again, I'm only in my booth, but I think that a lot of companies have come to grips with this reality. It was a trend that we started at Drew Estate as one of the larger companies. And I think most of the big companies have finally seen the wisdom in that approach to the show. If you just treat it as, oh, I'm just here to write an order, then you're really not leveraging the show to the best of your ability. Because the media part of it is a critical element.
Well, I'm going to take them all to dinner, so I'm buying their 94 Love. Plus, exactly. I'm taking them all out for steak.
Also, that you weren't just drunk that night when you said there was a rumor that you were drunk.
No, of course, I'll take you guys.
Oh, that's awesome.
I'm not spending $9,000 on a single meal at Bazaar Meats like I did last year, but. So what something Steve said made me think of this, which was, you know, for me, the show is different. For us, the show is different than it is for Steve and for Hector, because in our business, we have two kind of sides. We have the factory and we have the business on the U.S. side. And the show really is Mike's show, Mike Rosales' show. So Mike is there with John. We'll be there with John and Danny and all the people from our office. They'll be there from the time, you know, the show opens to the time the show ends, and they're writing orders and doing that. I generally have a different job at the show. The show's not that for me. There are certain people that I have to meet in the booth at certain times, but there are people, for example, people from Lancaster Leaf or people from growers in Brazil or people that we buy tobacco from that I don't get to see any other time of the year, that I have meetings set up throughout the day with those people, with Esteban to talk to them. You know, it saves me a ticket to Brazil. It saves me a ticket to the Dominican. It saves me a ticket to, you know, to Miami. So, there's that, there's the conversation, you know, the socializing at night, so I usually roll in about noon-ish, hard, you know, at the crack of noon, and usually I'm walking around. I'm not stuck in the booth like Hector and Steve are. So, I mean, the show is a little bit different for me from that perspective.
Well, I mean, we all use the trade show differently, and I kind of agree with what Steve said earlier, but what Skip said makes sense. You know, for us, obviously, the show is to highlight the company, the products, and it also gives Eric a chance to make contact with some of these retailers that we don't see as often. We don't have that great coverage throughout the country. Sometimes there's a retailer, we only see him at the show. That's right. The only time of the year that we'll talk to him. You know, but for me, you know, outside of showcasing our products and me being upset that it's, you know, that's only day one of the show, for me, the show is like, you know, personally, for me, the show is like the winter baseball meetings. Who's going where? Who's hot? Who's on the hot seat? Well, what company is, what did this company do? What's that company doing? You know, I catch up with those four or five industry friends of mine that I have, and just hopefully, you know, make an impact. And at the end of the day, at the end of the third and a half day, you sit there and you went, okay, this was worth it. You know, it's where we're looking for our 20-25% of our business for the year. But nobody comes to see me. They come to see Eric, and they want to, you know, I'll talk to some people who I have some relationship with, but the show's different for all of us. But, I'll tell you, in the last 3 years, the show does fly by. Luckily, it flies by. You know, I don't get to come in there at noonish. You know, I'm usually the first. I'm the first guy at the booth every year. I'm the first guy at the booth, but it gives me that 30 minutes or to an hour that I can tell myself it's going to be okay. You're not going to kill anybody today. You're going to be fine. And you know, and this year with a new setup, you know, hopefully we'll have a better flow and we can, you know, and it'll be July 2nd before we know it.
And you'll be happy, right?
Well, don't get crazy.
I've seen you happy in the booth. No, maybe I haven't.
It's usually the last day.
Yeah. It's usually the last day. So Aaron, I think we hit a few of the first three points here, actually. Yep. on all this.
I have a question for the other two guys. Yep. You guys calculate your sales as you go along.
Yeah,
we do.
We take the sales orders. And it's going to be harder this year because we don't have Angela there, who usually has historically kind of sat in the closet and just entered orders. But we generally, at the end of every day, have a summary of the customer will have in their email the actual physical sales order by the end of the day.
Right.
Every day.
We're taking office staff for the first time. We're taking Danielle, who works in our office. She's going to be going to the show. And as the orders are being taken, the orders are going to be sent to Miami.
Yeah,
it's 2019. We're trying to be at least, 2005 ready.
Whereas we have we don't actually calculate the orders while we're at the trade show. I almost don't want to know, because I think they give you can feel like you're doing really well or you're doing really bad. You know what I mean? That's almost better. I kind of stick my head in the sand for a few days.
He's so full of shit.
I'm telling you, that's what we do.
No, you set the bar. No one's going to buy me this cigar. And then
I only had 300 people here today.
Yeah, exactly. Look, flow, traffic is really critical. And you have to assume that if you have traffic, you're getting orders. But remember, I'm so busy interacting with the media and doing those drop-ins of, hey, really appreciate the support. Thank you. Hey, how's your wife doing? Haven't seen you in a long time conversations. But I'm not really actively involved. I think last trade show, I think I wrote 3 orders maybe during the course of 3.5 days.
Yeah, but how many did Cindy and your son write?
Well, again, you'd have to ask Cindy. I don't actually know.
You don't know shit. We should have had Cindy on the show. Look, I'm going to tell you this.
What?
We were across from Skid Spoof last year, and we were just about a 20-yard walk from Steve's. And the 2 or 3 times that I did get out of the booth, I couldn't talk to either one of them. And I got out of the booth because I needed a break because we all 3 of our booths were very busy. God bless, God willing, and it'll be the same. So I think that, listening to Steve, with the poor guy, but he knows he did well. I mean, Jesus, I went over one time when I walked over, and he had guys kneeling down next to him like he was an apostle. Like he was Jesus, and they were his apostles. He was telling them a story.
What I'm saying is we don't actually know the totals. We don't. I know what Drew, we used to calculate. We knew the penny of sales by the end of every day.
But that's how we do it. Staff
that was capable of doing the work. Because you're not capable of doing that work without the staff. You didn't have the staff to do it. And I'm not saying that will always be the future, but there is a certain element to not knowing in some weird way is better, I think, given the environment.
It doesn't matter because if Coop or someone asks you, you're going to say, "Oh man, the show is dead. It's a horrible show, but it was a good show for us."
Yeah.
Fire kickers weren't dead. That's why.
Yeah, I can tell you. Here's the way it breaks down for us, and we've done it like 8-9 years now. So I can pretty much tell you this is the way it's going to go. We're going to be busy from opening bell to closing bell. They're going to have to kick people out of our booth. The security never fails, kicks people out of our booth. On the first and second day, the third day is probably going to be a couple of times where Mike can actually go to the bathroom and grab something to eat. And then the last day, it's going to be pretty much a ghost town with media people and a lot of the big guys come. Or our regular, our biggest customers, not necessarily famous in those guys, but our guys who know they're going to order from us, they come the last day so they can sit down and drink and rest and smoke a cigar and take their time. So it's a different pace on the last day. But, we do about 25% of our annual sales at the trade show. We'll sell through all the inventory we're going to have for the next 3 or 4 months. We'll be back ordered until November, December. Every shipment that comes in will be 100% sold. And probably the first or second day are usually pretty even. It really depends on who came in. Like if Famous or CI or Jeff from Corona comes in on Monday, then Monday's or the first day, then the first day is a little bigger than the second day. But we do 70% of the business in 2 days, probably 20% on the third day, and, you know, whatever's left over, 5-10% on the last day.
You know, I've noticed a shift for us. Originally, for us, day two and day three were our best days. And last year, we were really busy on the first and the second day and not as busy on the last day.
Right, so because
the show has gone on for us. We originally were a bit more back end, and now we've become a little bit more front end as far as traffic and meetings and appointments.
That's because retailers generally, I mean, I think this is an overall general statement, is they go knock out the ones that they already know what they want to order on the first couple of days through an appointment. And then the days after that, they have a list of people they want to try to catch. So you've shifted from being a company that people want to go see and maybe open an account and maybe expand to an account that's already established and they want to get their order in early, right? Yeah. Because especially we process orders first in, first out. So if someone comes in on the first day of the trade show and places an order, that may ship in July or August. If someone comes in on day three of the trade show, that might ship in September, October.
We do the same thing. We process the orders, not to a time stamp, but pretty much in the general order in which they come in. So, yes, orders that are placed on day one, day two are going to get fulfilled probably before day three, day four, depending on inventory levels, of course. If we have it all, we'd love to fulfill it all at one time, but it just depends on what's actually ordered. And look, it's very hard to gauge what's going to be ordered. I mean, you never quite really know. I mean, it's a bit of a crapshoot, particularly when it comes to, you know, particularly the new stuff is the hardest thing to gauge. I mean, you really have no, I have yet to get my head around the amount of new product that's appropriate coming into the trade show. I just haven't yet.
Are you guys concerned? Okay, we talked about the business you do there, but trade show, I hear that the costs are going up every year to do the trade show. Is this something that's keeping you guys up at night?
Did you not catch Skip's post this morning?
I did not.
We've had this conversation at our place every year, and Eric likes the show, comparatively speaking. He likes the show.
Right.
But, you know, the bringing in the cigars, the weight of the stuff coming in. I remember 1 year we needed an extension run. It was $800 to run an extension cord.
Yeah.
Costs are incredible.
You ready for this?
We're going to spend it in Vegas. The rooms are what they are. The flight is what it is. You try to get it early. Those costs you're gonna have to absorb anyway. But this the stuff that's going on at the show this year, now that they took it back to the Sands, I've never really been involved with the pricing, but I hear, and you know, taking into consideration the fact that putting a banner went up 100% from 3 years ago, that's ridiculous. That's ridiculous.
You know the black drape you're supposed to get free with your booth? Last year, we thought we were going to have a printed wall, but it didn't get delivered in time. So we ended up having to, when we got the show, say, hey, we need that free black drape with our booth. You didn't get the free black drape because you had told them you were going to do something else. So for those black drapes, that you got for free, it was $2,800. And the choice was pay the $2,800 or don't have the black drape. And those are the type of things that are really, that I think people would be very surprised. I mean, the electrical costs are much lower at the Sands this year than they've been. But I remember last year at the Las Vegas Convention Center, the first 15 amp circuit was like $1,795 for 15 amps of power for 3.5 days. You're basically talking what, 28 hours of power at 15 amps. You were paying $1,795 for that. I mean, the costs are very hard to swallow. The cost for the vacuuming, the cost for getting the trash dumped. You do, I would say you're getting nickel and dime, but you're not getting nickel and dime. What you're getting is you're getting dime $100 bills and C notes. That's what's happening the whole time. It is crazy expensive. And that's one of the things that in some way it hurts the show too, because it's getting to the point now where the costs have so escalated that it's now precluding the guys that are really small. You know, the guys that have a 10 by 10 booth and they just want to have a table with a tablecloth thrown over it and a couple Reynolds chairs. I mean, it's very hard to do the trade show for much less than 15 to 20 K out of pocket. And that's if you do nothing other than just physically be there. That price point freezes a lot of people out, and it's not good, because all those little things. I mean, I know some of the bigger manufacturers say, "Well, wow, you know, that's just less competition." Wow. But I also think all those little things are part of what attracts retailers to come to the show to see things. Look, all the retailers know for the most part what we're all releasing. We get all that information out in advance. So there's very little, hey, I discovered that this at the trade show. What you do discover is you do discover that little 10 by 10 guy. That's one of the elements of, hey, I want to find that diamond in the rough. I want to find that unique thing that I've never heard or seen before. And as costs continue to escalate, it starts to freeze those companies out, which I think ultimately isn't good for trade show attendance. And I don't know how to fix it, because the costs just keep escalating. We're experiencing in Nicaragua where our costs are going up in Nicaragua. Skip and I had this conversation when I was down there last time. They're talking about this new tax. I mean, as the costs go up, everything just keeps getting more expensive, and we all have to start making decisions about what we can do and what we can't do. In my own case, I honestly need a slightly bigger booth. I have a 20 by 40. I probably could have used at least a 20 by, no, it's 20 by 30. I could have used probably a 20 by 40, but I was reluctant to do it, because to add that other 10, you know, just another 200 square feet, once you add up the carpeting and the ancillary drayage expenses and all that, to add that extra 200 square feet is going to end up being probably somewhere around 10K in the end. Mm-hmm. And that makes me reluctant to do it.
Well, my concern this year, so I don't think it's any surprise to anybody. I like to budget, right? I don't mind spending money. Last year we spent about $140,000, because we expanded the size of our booth and bought some new furniture. That was about, you know, 50,000 of that. And this year I thought, okay, we're going to get a little bit of a good guy, because we don't have to build any new parts of the booth. We don't have any, you know, we have a couple of new tables and stools because we have more sales guys, but we don't have to build like big metal chunks of the booth anymore like we did last year.
Right.
So I had a line item budget down to, you know, the $100 trash can and the all that stuff, right? And it is, of course, obscene, the prices, but it is what it is, right? I just look at the budget. What concerned me this year was the electrical is about the same. It's 5% more than it was last year, and we're getting another run out of it, so it actually is a little bit cheaper. But there are a couple of line items, like the drayage has gone up 30%.
Yes.
The big one is the one I posted today.
It's gone up crazy.
Yeah, the big one is the one I posted today, which is the also the padding went up double for some reason. The carpet didn't go up double, but the padding for some reason went up double. So, you know, you have to, just to give you guys some concept, a 10 by 10 square of the cheapest possible fucking carpet you can imagine, which is the highest quality carpet they have, with an inch of padding, and I would get 4 inches of padding if they would let me. that 10 by 10 square of carpet costs like 5 or 6 times more than what it would cost you to buy the most expensive, you know, a fucking Arab rug. I mean, I could cover the floor with $10,000 rugs and it would be cheaper. And, you know, so
the problem is you got to pay the drayage to get those rugs in and out, and then you got to pay the storage fee to keep those rugs for a whole year to use them for just 4 days.
Right.
Every year we go to this question on our end, should we buy our own carpeting and padding? We ask ourselves every year, and every time we do that, it actually ends up not being that great a savings to actually own the carpet and the padding.
Like, right. Do you rent a couch for $1,250 for 3 days, or which you could buy three couches, or do you go buy a couch for $400 and then store it all year and have it delivered, and it costs the same. So they get you one way or the other. The thing that I posted today was we have these cloth banners. All the banners plus the two poles that go in them weigh about 65 pounds. We've done it for the last 3 years, the exact same thing. 2 years at the Sands, it was like $2,500, $2,600. Last year at Las Vegas Convention Center, it was $1,700, which I was really happy about. It still is a ripoff because what happens, they come over on this cherry picker thing. They go, hey, we're doing it right now or we're not doing it. The guy walks over and he goes, hey, he's going to be here in 5 minutes. Are you ready? So you set it all out. They come over. They hook a wire to it. They lift it up in the air. The whole exercise takes 4 minutes, right? And historically, they've charged us an hour worth of union labor for the guy on the lift, an hour to watch the lift, and a guy on the bottom to hook it up to the wire. So there's three guys at, you know, $97 an hour for 1 hour. And it's been what it is. But this year, they have this new rule, minimum 4 hours of labor coming and going. So that's 8 hours of labor for four guys, because now they need two guys down at the bottom instead of just one to hook it up. And then now they're putting all these special motorized hanging things and breakaways and catch wires for a 65-pound cloth sign. So, you know, my question to them was, okay, how did this go from $1,700 or $2,600 to $6,000? And there's like 80 line items. There's a light that they have to shine on it, an electrical to hook up the light. And I'm like, we didn't ask for any of that. So today I told them, hey, I'm paying $2,500 or I'm not paying anything. So they came back and said, okay, we'll do it for $3,600. And I'm like, we're not going to do that. Like, but here's the problem, and this is where I was getting to. The problem is you can't budget for it because they don't tell you months in advance, hey, if you have the same stuff you had last year, it's this much per pound in drayage, it's this much. You get the carpet and stuff about a month ahead of time, but these last-minute things, you'll be standing on the trade show floor the day of the setup, and somebody from Shepherd will whip over in the cart and give you a bill for $1,800, and it's like, what is this? Or the second day of the show, somebody will come up with a $900 bill for vacuuming. It's like, we specifically told you not to vacuum our floor, right? And then you have to go over during the middle of your busiest time, you have to walk over to the Shepherd booth and argue with them over a bill. And the whole thing is just a designed ripoff, man. And it's here's the bottom line. The bottom line is this. It's already on the teetering edge of whether there's a cost benefit to us attending. It's been like that for 2 years, right?
That's where I wanted to ask. Yep.
And where we've gone back and forth in our discussions is we've said, look, the $25,000 or $30,000 we pay for the actual real estate goes to IPCPR. And to the extent that our party and our nice-looking booth and our happy faces, to the extent that that gets retailers to come that wouldn't otherwise come, then we are doing our part in the ecosystem to help make the show successful. And that has an expense to it, and we don't expect any return on that expense, right? We're just doing it as to be a good partner in the community of the industry. But it does come to a point, and Villiger made this decision, and other companies have made this decision, that they're going to either do one of two things. Either they're not going to show up, or they're going to really scale back I could scale back to what Sokka does, which is set up 5 rented tables with 20 rented stools.
Wait a minute. I own that stuff.
No, but I'm saying I could go back to the picnic tables or the sofas or whatever you want to call it. I could go back to just the simple, here's a place to sit down to write your order and then get GFO, right? and I could absolutely do that. And that's the direction we're going to have to go. If they keep hitting us with these unpredictable charges. So here's a question, Coop. Does it make a difference? Because you know, jaded Steve Sacco earlier today said these big boots are really just about, you know, how big your Johnson is. But if when I walked on that show the first time, it was the pretty, beautiful boots and the interesting presentation of the products and all those things that made it like Charlie's Chocolate Factory. If we want to make it like Soviet, like Chernobyl, right? And we want to just have nothing but black carpet, rented tables and stools, and every booth looks the same, then what's the purpose of a trade show?
That's why it goes back earlier, why consumers want to go. There, you know, it's kind of like the city. I call it like the city that's up for like 2.5, 3.5 days. There's something to it. Yeah, and I think it does put you in a positive mood seeing this stuff. And maybe, you know, going into a nice booth and having a cigar with people, I could see it. But if you go into a booth and you can't stand around, it's a problem. You know, you can't sit down or it's cramped, it's a problem.
So if it becomes utilitarian, then it loses something. I don't know how to describe that, but if everything becomes utilitarian, it loses something. And if it loses that, then fewer people will come. And if fewer people come, then there's less business to be done. If there's less business to be done, then there's no reason to go. I'm better off buying every one of my sales guys, you know, 10 more airplane tickets to go to individual stores and having a custom. I mean, I have a beautiful facility in Austin. I could bring 1,000, 500,000 people to Austin, give them cigars, feed them barbecue, have live music. I could do that. Invite consumers, have my own kind of consumer day defined the way I want it. I could do that for less than what I spend in Las Vegas every year.
This might be a good argument for my three words are Seminole Hard Rock Casino that's getting built next year. That's going to be finished next year in Florida. All right. There is Las Vegas. They've already showed us the options. Orlando, what was the problem with Orlando? Nobody was together. Nobody saw each other after the show. There were no places. You know, we went to Corona's for 2 days to smoke in the inflatable tent. New Orleans was possibly the door to hell. How hot was it in New Orleans? You know, I wasn't in the industry when they went to Houston, so I don't know how Houston was. But it's Vegas. Vegas may have us by the balls as an industry. But hey,
Center was nice.
How come we have never gone to Florida? How come we don't do this in Florida? It doesn't have to be Miami.
The Hard Rock.
You know, they're building a brand new casino there. They're building that brand new casino there on the reservation in Broward County, which is one county up from Miami. They smoke in the casino. It's a brand new casino with a convention center.
Big Smoke went to. Did they go to Hard Rock? Didn't Big Smoke go to Hard Rock earlier this year?
They went. I think it was last year that they were at the Hard Rock.
Okay. They went somewhere this year where it was much more smoker friendly. I heard, but it wasn't in Miami.
It would be nice to have an option, but there's no option. And even in Vegas, you saw how everybody bitched about being at the other convention center.
I don't care where we do it. It only costs me about $1,100 or $1,200 to put my crates on a truck and send them to anywhere in the country. It costs $12,000, $15,000 to get them from the back door to my
Unbelievable.
I don't have any juice in this. I don't know if Steve or Skip, but has anybody ever mentioned Florida to them outside of Orlando?
You know, I'll go back to my point, Steve, which is it really is getting to the point where if we as Roma Craft are considering really cutting back our booth and maybe not coming in a year or two, that means there's got to be other companies that are making that decision.
Look, I think we all entertain that conversation every year. And I've always gone back to the fallback that, look, I wouldn't personally take the tack that Villiger decided to take. I thought it was a mistake on their part. But I can see a future where maybe we don't actually try to generate orders at the trade show. And we just show up with a 10x20 and some coffee tables and some sofas. And we just shake hands and smile and, you know, sneak in some booze. I mean, it may just come to that where you treat it almost just social entirely. I mean, for us currently, look, we're still a very young company. So there's a lot of retailers out there that for us, the show still has an upside for.
If they come to the show.
But even with the limited numbers that come, there's still room for us to grow. I think the bigger issue is for the very big guys, they already have everybody. So when the attendance goes down, it raises their cost per order. And I think for the very small guys who are just trying to hook one out of every 40 or 50 people to take a look at their stuff, as the traffic goes down, there's just less people that you get by just the law of averages. So I think there's a certain segment that benefits from the show still, but I think at the two outer edges, the very large companies and the very small companies are the ones that actually have the most undue costs with the way the show is currently structured. And for the people that are probably doing the best of the show, you and I and Eric and everybody, we're still asking ourselves, is it worth it? You know, I just go into it, like you said, I look at it as being part of the ecosystem, part of being a good cigar citizen, part of being part of the industry. I mean, I want the show to be successful. In whatever iteration that ultimately becomes, I do like the fact that there is some sort of show. But I don't know what the future is. I really don't.
I mean, I agree. We throw this party. This party costs us about $100 per head. It's not cheap. I mean, every time someone walks up to the bar and orders a drink, of which if they don't, we still have to pay for the drink.
That's correct.
You know, it costs us, this party is going to cost us somewhere in the neighborhood of $30,000 to $40,000, right? Just to entertain people for 4 or 5 hours. Right. But we don't mind doing that because there's a lot of people, especially our friends in the industry and the media guys, who don't have dinners or other things to go to, and it's nice for them to have something that they can come to. So we've always had fun with our, whether it was the balcony in New Orleans or the hospitality suite we did every night in Vegas. This year we've gone to a single night, but you know, I don't begrudge spending that $50,000. I begrudge spending the $6,000 to hang a fucking banner from the roof. That it's a different thing.
I agree with both of you, but here's my question. I mean, I don't know if you guys agree with me. Shouldn't we have a contingency plan?
That again, Hector, you broke up.
I agree with both of you. I think you guys both make good points about being a good part of the cigar community, and you know, and while you're there, making the best of it. Just get this thing. But shouldn't there be a contingency plan? Shouldn't does the IPCPR not notice how they're, you know, I don't want to say the nickel and diming us, but they have the subtlety of a pimp with the way that we're being treated there at the convention center. Have they not sat and went, well, maybe we should look at another option?
Well, I don't know that they have, but I'll tell you to the point that that Coop made the other day, which is, it used to be that if you didn't show up for the show, that you were dead as a company, that was the sign that you were done, and whether it was real or imagined. With a very few exceptions, if you didn't show up at the show, you were done in the industry. I think this year, as of this year, that's no longer true.
No.
And I think if a company our size at our level of success decides not to go, that gives the air cover for a whole lot of people not to do it if they're.
And Villiger not going, they're not going because Villiger's kind of hot. They hit the top 25 2 years in a row. They've had buzz at the end of the year.
Right.
And they were, how big was their booth?
It's a cost benefit analysis. They're looking at the cost and saying that it isn't worth it. Where I disagree with their strategy is, I think Rene Castellano being at the trade show is good for the company. And I would have had a 10 by 20. I would have had something. I would have just been there.
You don't have to. I agree. I agree. I agree with that.
Look, Fuente doesn't write orders at the trade show. Fuente, for the size of a company that they are, their booth is relatively modest, I think. You know,
right.
I mean, it's still a big, beautiful booth, and they do a great job. But in the scale of things, I mean, look at the Ashton booth compared to the Fuente booth. I mean, so I think, and that's kind of where I'm kind of on that glide path too. I think, okay, will there be a point where I'll say, okay, let me not worry about, hey, having to have a dozen people to handle the show. Granted, we don't need a dozen people now, but I'm looking down the road. You know, is there a path where maybe your approach to the show is differently? And look, the costs are always going to be a component to this because these costs ultimately get bared by the consumers. They end up going into the cost of the cigars. They just simply do. And all of us don't want our cigars to cost more than they have to cost, because it always has an impact on sales. So it gets to a point where you just have to make a decision. I know currently, and this is one of the reasons why, I know, like, for example, Nick is doing a much larger booth this year. He's decided to do that. I decided to basically, okay, I want to do another year in the same size format and, you know, and look at the numbers again after the trade show. You know, but I don't know whether one approach is better than the other. You know, for me, you know, I don't want to be to the point that it's so utilitarian that it's terrible, but at the same time, I don't want to be extravagant about it either. You know, and look, you see a lot of booths that are pretty extravagant for the size of the company. But part of that is, too, them, you know, kind of puffing their chest out. And, you know, that thing, you know, you fake it till you make it kind of scenario. I mean, your first trade show, Skip, what were you? You were in a 10x10 booth and two chairs behind a table, if I remember correctly.
We had a Yeti cooler, a old pharmacy cabinet, and a kitchen table from World Market.
I remember the first time I saw Ernesto Perez Carrillo at a trade show. He literally had one of those cocktail tables. He had like two of the rental stools. He had two boxes of cigars on the cocktail table. He had some sort of like pop-up banner, and that's, you know, that's how he did the trade show. I mean,
that's the way he still does Enter Tobacco, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, look, it's just, I think this,
I don't know.
The point is, we are all struggling with this question of, we all want to do the show, but how can we make it work the best for all the parties involved?
Yeah, and I don't know how interesting this topic is to the average consumer. Maybe it's not interesting at all. I don't know what list of topics you have. We've beat this one to death. But, yeah, you know, it kind of goes into this other discussion about pricing or price increases, which you mentioned the increasing of costs, which we could talk about for a while if you want. But I know you got kind of beat up over your price increase announcement.
Not really.
We just announced ours today. I mean, that's something we could talk about too, which may be more interesting to consumers.
Let me say what's really important from a consumer, because I'm assuming most of the people watching this are consumers. What I want them to understand is, we on our end as manufacturers or as importers or brand owners, we really never want to raise the cost. In our ideal world, the cost would be fixed and frozen and they could go on indefinitely. I mean, because there's a catch side. When we raise our price to the consumer, there's always the fear that it's going to, in some way, decrease the number of units sold. And the way the cigar industry works is it's based on efficiencies. And when you sell less cigars, it means every single cigar you sell ends up costing you physically more. So it's always with great trepidation, for the most part, that we raise prices. It's something that I don't think most companies go, oh wow, we're raising the cost, it's gonna be great, look at all the extra profit we're gonna make, because that isn't the way it actually ends up working. Normally you end up waiting until the bitter last moment and you keep putting off the price increases because you don't want to jeopardize the sales you have, until it gets to the point you say, wow, I can't really afford to make this if I'm not getting a certain amount of money. You always have to make a decision about, okay, if you want to maintain the quality, then you have to raise the price. If you want to maintain the price, then you've got to lower the quality. Or the third decision is you decide, hey, I just simply can't make that anymore because it just isn't cost effective. So it's really important for consumers to understand, very, very rarely does a company raise prices with the intent of, oh, we're going to make more profit. It's more about trying to get back to where they were when they started with what the original price was. And it's not something that I don't think any companies take it willy-nilly. It's a decision that no company that I've ever been involved with ever does without great trepidation.
Okay, guys, what I think we're going to do is we'll do a quick commercial break. If you guys want to take a bio break, feel free. I'll do some commercial reads, and then we'll get into some more topics here. Okay, so without further ado, Since 1888, Billiger Cigars have been experts in everything tobacco, including offering a wide range of premium cigars for all connoisseurs. Billiger's La Vencedora, which translates to the victor, is the first full-bodied Billiger cigar, and it carries a special meaning to Billiger chairman of the board, Heinrich Billiger. The Billiger La Vencedora represents to Mr. Billiger the arrival of Billiger cigars in the premium handmade cigar segment. It was time, in his opinion, to push the envelope and create a legacy cigar that would serve as a proper follow-up to the acclaimed Billiger La Florida and Glen brand. This Nicaraguan Puro is wrapped in a beautiful Nicaraguan Habano Oscuro wrapper, boasting a potent full-bodied smoking experience featuring seasoned and hearty flavors. Be sure to ask your retailer for La Vencedora, and you can visit Billiger's entire line of premium cigars at www.billigercigars.com. And by Tailored Smoke, located in the heart of downtown Charlotte's epicenter, Tailored Smoke is your one-stop shop for a tailored smoking experience. And by JRE Tobacco, the authentic Corojo leaf is one of the most robust and flavorful leaves out there. During the golden age of cigars in Cuba, it was the leaf of choice to make some of the world's greatest cigars. Because it is one of the most challenging ones to cultivate, it fell out of favor by the 1990s. In the Jamestown Valley in Honduras, Julio Arroyo took on the challenge in growing Corojo from the original seeds, and in 2000, he successfully reintroduced authentic Corojo back to the market. With over 50 years of experience in the tobacco business, from growing and curing tobacco to cigar production, the Arroyo Tobacco Farm has been able to continue to deliver products to market with authentic Corojo. Now with JRE Tobacco, Julio and San Justo bring their very own brand to market, each containing the authentic Corojo leaf. Tatascano is a mild to medium cigar, both Connecticut and Habano wrapper. Rancho Luna is a premium medium cigar that is available in Habano and Maduro. And Aladino is available in a 100% authentic Corojo Puro or San Andres Maduro, representing the golden age of cigars from 1947 to 1961. Now available at your local retailer, be sure to ask for JRE Tobacco, a legacy that is tasted in every drawer. And by Cornelius and Anthony. If you're going to be wanted for something, be wanted for something great. That's what Cornelius Bailey set out to do five generations ago, and that's what Stephen Bailey is doing with Cornelius and Anthony cigars. Using the finest tobaccos, Cornelius and Anthony brings to you Daddy Mac, Venganza, Meridian, Cornelius, Ariel, Senior East Sugars, and the recently released Gent and Mistress. You can find them at your local tobacconist. Welcome, everybody. We're back on primetime episode 99. This is our IPCPR pregame series, the second installment with Steve Saka, Skip Martin, and Hector Alfonso here. And I believe we lost Hector for a bit, but he should be returning. But anyway, let's kind of get into a couple more topics here in regards to the trade show. And Hector's back, so it's perfect timing. So it was good timing, Hector.
Thank you.
As far as kind of maybe a little bit lighter, a couple of lighter topics on the trade show, you know, in my opinion, question for all you guys, when is the right time to announce your product? Do you do it at the do you do it before the trade show, or do you wait till the trade show? And I've seen different companies do it. And I think all you guys, for the most part, announce your stuff before the trade show.
I always announce our product as we start working on it, right?
Yeah.
So we'll work on a concept for 6 months to a year. Once it gets to the point where we've got it kind of nailed down in terms of what we want to do and we're finalizing the blend and the sizes and the artwork and that stuff, that's when we kind of plug the consumer into it from the factory and start letting them know what we're working on so that, you know, for example, with Baca, I started working with Jack Tarano on a project that, you know, wasn't fully baked, but we started working on it maybe, what, Hector, like a year and a half, 2 years ago?
Last year, during football season, I remember.
Yeah, at least a year ago. And then, mm-hmm. I mean, we've been talking about it for even years beyond that, but we actually really started making cigars about a year ago. That changed into something else, which changed into something else. But we started talking about Baca probably 5 or 6 months ago. That cigar won't actually hit the market until November or so. So, you know, that's how we do it. We don't do any of the grand unveiling of projects the way the bigger companies mm-hmm. do.
Yeah, I remember the same. You did that same approach with Neanderthal. As well, I do remember that.
We've been doing it that way since Cro-Magnon.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
But let me ask you this, Skip. I mean, I know it isn't really calculated. I mean, a lot of it is because we're also interactive on social media. We just like to share what we're working on. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so yeah, for like, me, that's it.
I mean, so it really, it isn't like there's some great scheme in it. I know that, like, you know, certain people are always big on the press release part of it, but the reality is I haven't written the press releases yet for the two new products we're introducing at the trade show, even though the Brulee blend was actually a blend that was done way back in 2015, you know, as one of the alternatives on the original Sober Mesa, you know, so that I kind of held tight to the vest because I knew it wasn't going to be something that we were prepared to do for a while. But I think a lot of these things, I know from my end, and I think from most of ours, it's really just kind of a, almost like an organic thing. As it happens, you're sharing photos, you're talking about it. And I know that we all get excited about what we're working on. And, you know, you want to kind of share it because you yourself are excited. I mean, you always kind of fall in love with what you're currently focused on. And I think that that's part of it.
I think one of the things that's changed, though, is, you know, this time, this year, a couple of maybe like a week ago, was the first time I ever got a notice, a legal kind of interaction based on something that I was working on that was new, saying, hey, this isn't on your ingredient listing. We have to update your ingredient listing because I saw this release on Half Wheel. And it was for the Cigar Dojo Pennsylvania. And essentially my response was, it's a one and done. It's the same size, essentially, quote unquote, the same blend as the Intemperance AWS. So I'm not going to amend my ingredient listing. But the point being is with this story last week about social media influencers and warning labels in the vape industry, you got to be really careful anymore about talking about, you know, what's in your cigar, you know, pretty much anything, just because we have no idea what the rules are, really. Everybody has different opinions, but, you know, no one's ever successfully got a substantial equivalence. No one has introduced a new product in terms of pre-market product approval. So the more stuff that goes out there officially to Coop and to Half Wheel, the more I have to answer to later on potentially. So it's becoming less and less. We certainly say a lot less about our cigars than we used to say.
Well, I see that across the board too. I mean,
we don't also, when we're working on something new, I mean, like Steve said, we like to tease it, you know, there'll be a picture of the factory smoking something without a ban, but you know, we've tried to avoid the word new. We've tried to avoid using the word new at any expense. And, you know, until we have it here, until we're ready to show it, you won't, you know, and we won't do a press release and we won't even mention it. It's what Skip's saying is true. I mean, they're cracking down on social media. What is it? What do you call, what's the word? Social media influencers. How long before they start, you know, the Orwellian process starts with us, you know, hey, you guys mentioned something that's not in your, you know, it's not something you guys mentioned before. It's going to generate a ton of work that we are not ready to, really deal with.
I've gotten feedback from Europe that things that I've done on social media violate TPD. And I basically tell them, fuck you. I texted years ago from the European Union. But you know, I'm from the you know, Texas. I don't really care about your rules. I'm posting from Nicaragua for a company based in Texas. Like, it has nothing to do with the European market. Like, how do you police that? But that's where we're headed in the U.S.
It's true. It's sad, but true. You know, it's sad, but true. And, you know, the fact that nobody's giving you press releases, Coop, I take that super. Person.
Well, I mean, the problem we have with the
press release. So many damn press releases a cycle, it's insane.
No, the problem.
Oh my God, this.
The problem is when a press release goes to someone, and then when we call about it, we have no comment. We can't talk about it, or they don't return your message.
Oh, you know what it is, man. All right.
Well, oh, we know what it is. We all know what that is.
Yeah, you know what it is.
Yeah. I mean,
small company that used the collective cigar media for the first couple of years while they were creating a buzz.
Yep.
Then all of a sudden they have some buzz, and now they're too good for you guys.
Yep.
You know, they're too busy telling tall tales. They're busy. They're too busy telling tall tales about a tobacco that doesn't really grow in that region, but they have it and they can do it. And now all of a sudden, you know, we only talk to CA. Come on, man.
I read a story about a cigar today. I picked out at least 10 things that are complete and total bullshit. But
did you read about that on Coop and Aaron's site by any chance?
I don't know.
Oh, thank goodness. Okay. All right. We're not going to
get it. You got to be careful. You got some salty cats on here now.
Yeah, they are. They do listen. They tell you, there are people who listen to the show, believe it or not. All right. So, you know, the other thing I've heard from a few manufacturers is that they're feeling a squeeze from TAA more, that there's a lot of buying that happens at the Tobacconists Association of America mini trade show. There's a lot of money spent. Now, all of a sudden, that the budgets are a little tighter going into IPCPR. Have you guys felt any of that at all?
It doesn't affect us at all.
It doesn't affect me either. It's again, it does at TAA. It's the largest companies. They're giving crazy discounts because they're starving for cash. It's at the end of the Q1 cycle, which is always a more difficult time in our business. And what you're seeing is you're seeing some of the old guard retailers basically spend an entire year's budget on pretty much mainstay style products. And that doesn't affect our consumers for the most part. It's really kind of almost a non-issue. And to be honest with you, I mean, a lot of the TAA accounts, there's some really good ones. Look, they're all good in their own way, but a lot of them aren't really the best environment for a cigar brand that's like Skip's or Eric's or myself. You know, it's a totally different world. They, they're living on the Fuente, General, Altadis, Perdomo, Oliva style bandwagon. You know, they're catering to a different customer that's buying a different style cigar, often at a different price point. And my thing with TAA is, yeah, I'd like to be a part of it because it's one of the few cigar things my wife enjoyed every year, because you spend 3.5 days and you're really only interacting with 70 customers, which is very enjoyable because you really get enough face-to-face time with people. Whereas at the IPCPR, you have a lot of 10-minute conversations that are never long enough. So that's one of the benefits of TAA. But from a business perspective, TAA, I don't think, has really much of an impact on our company. And I'm pretty sure it probably doesn't on the other two.
But I'll make a prediction, Coop, and I'll bet you a pretty good chunk of money on this, that out of our three companies, the first one who will join TAA and go to be a part of the super percolator or whatever they call it will be Steve.
Look, I'm being honest with you. My wife liked going to TAA. She enjoyed the event. And look, it's a good way to interact for 3.5 days. You do learn a lot talking to people guys in that environment. It's
personally, you know, would it be nice to do a TAA exclusive? Sure, absolutely. You know, as a nerd, I've seen how people lose their shit over these TAA blends. And, you know, and in my role with the factory responsible for some of these blends, you know, it would be great to have a TAA exclusive that you'll get a little buzz on and people, you know, you get some feedback on it. But that's Eric's call, man, and it's a moot point in our office. I think we brought it up once, and he's like, you know, hey, they don't come to me, I'm not worried about it.
Yeah, you don't have the option of going to TAA. You have to.
Well, they come to us. Well, they come. They haven't come to us.
You have to be invited to go to
TAA. Right. They haven't. What I'm saying, they haven't come to us, and since they haven't, Eric's not. We've never mentioned it. Never been an issue.
I would think with you three guys, and I'm not saying because you're on the show, I think other people would agree with me. If you guys did a TAA cigar, I guarantee you'd have they would sell those things out. I mean, just from the amount of interest that it would generate, and because I see TAA cigars from 2015 still on the shelves.
But I said I could do any cigar. I mean, because first of all, we don't make bad cigars, you know.
Right.
At least Steve and I don't. I don't know about Hector, but
well, Steve makes best. Steve's another Steve cigar.
Yeah, I don't know what the guy with the hat's talking about. We do pretty good too.
All right, yeah, I think. But my point is that I could take 1,000 boxes and give it to any retailer, one or two retailers, and it's like giving them a check, a bag full of money. They're going to sell them because our customers support, you know, and I'm not bragging. I'm just saying our customers support because they know when we release something like that, it's not some other thing with a new, you know, label on it, or that it is something unique and different. And it generally sells within a few hours and then we move on. I do, you know, 6, 8, 12 months worth of work and it's sold out in 3 hours. Right. And the retailer makes 2 to 3 times more profit than I do. Right.
The TA would not get anything recycled from the three guys you have on here for sure.
Right. Yeah. You're going to have to put it in the discount bin. That's for sure.
That's 40%.
I can tell you there's one cigar this year in the TAA. I know it was released 3 years ago under another name as a limited edition.
I mean, Hector sold out a cigar called the Psychic Turtle. So
Psychedelic Turtle.
Yeah, so anything's possible.
Anything's possible.
All right, that's good. All right, media coverage. Here's a question I have for you guys. What does cigar media miss out on every year covering the trade show? This is your chance to kind of tell us, what do we do wrong that we need to do a better, better job at?
They don't miss out on Steve's list of cigars. He makes sure that they all are very aware of that.
Well, I'll tell you what, I know, I've already heard from some of the insiders that the meatballs he made at a store last year are going to be on the top 25. So, I mean, that's just alone. Just the meatballs that you made at that store up in New Hampshire are going to make the list.
You know, we did predict a win in that meatball contest, by the way.
Well, that was an obvious one. Who was going to put more OCD effort into a meatball than Steve Stockton?
Skip, have you thought about getting in on this meatball contest?
No, I don't.
I think you could win it. I think you could win. Gringo Cochino?
I don't cook for sport. I cook for love.
Oh, okay.
Wow. Look, I don't know if you guys miss a lot. I mean, to defend you guys, I've only done 7 of these shows, but I've noticed you guys have a pattern. You guys have a template. You come with questions. You have queries. Some companies, you have better relationships with others. You spend a little more time at the booth, you know, but what are you guys going to do? You told me yourself that you try to hit every one of them, and then you still missed some last year. You're going to miss some this year. And you're not going to make everybody happy because, you know, somebody's going to see you sitting at Skip's booth for the third time, or you're over there at Steve's getting yelled at, or you're over there at me hearing bitching about somebody, and they got butt hurt because, hey, you didn't walk over to Energia Cigars or some shit like that. You're doing the best you can. I mean, you know, and it's not easy. I mean, I'm not trying to defend you or blow wind up your skirt or your kilt or whatever, but it's hard, man. I mean, how much time do you get? How much can you cover? You know,
I think if there's anything that I would say, Coop, that, you know, when I, cause I've actually done it before, right? I did 2 straight trade shows for Doc Diaz. And what I made a concerted effort to do was to talk to people who I was interested in as a consumer that weren't necessarily getting a lot of attention from other people. So people like HVC or Jeremy Jack or, you know, those kind of people who aren't on these shows all the time, who, you know, try to get them some kind of attention in terms of, to maybe help their show be a little more worth, you know, the money that they put into going there. Right. And so I think people pile up at the Davidoff booth. Everybody's going to go see Matt Booth because that's probably the most entertaining interview of every show. But you know, there's some poor guy there begging for people to come into his booth who has something interesting. And so, you know, people like Spencer Drake, you know, you got to go see Spencer Drake because God knows he has the time to sit down and talk to you.
No ping pong.
Exactly. So, you know, if there's anything, which I think you guys do a great job. In fact, I think if they could get more media to come, you know, like television shows, and the way CES and those other big conventions do, if we could get even people outside of the industry to come and talk, where we could talk about our industry and talk about regulation and talk about how we're different than other tobacco products, I think, you know, that I think the IPPR would be well served to really to pay for those kinds of people to come into the show to cover us. But you guys do a great job. I don't have any, you know, say what you want to say about Half Wheel, but I mean, Half Wheel compared to, I remember way back in the day when it was Cigar Dave holding court on a stage somewhere, and versus what Stogie review and Nice Tight Ash and those guys started doing, you know, 8, 10, 12 years ago. It's only gotten better. So I think the show is very well covered by the new media, which is a good thing.
I think you guys should go cannibalize each other. That would be great. I mean, just, you know, I think, you know, you should have made a complaint. How come Half Wheel was on the floor the day before everybody else? No, seriously.
I don't actually understand that. Why does some media get access before the show and others don't?
They actually got space. And that's how they got around it, which was they totally – and here's the deal. We had an option to get the space. I couldn't justify the ROI. And, in fact, you know, they did – I talked to Charlie about this. They did their show from the trade show floor last year, and that's the day before, and they were able to do it because they had booth space, but there was one problem. There was no air conditioning to do a interview. To do a podcast, it's very difficult without air conditioning. So they had to move it this year to the Davidoff store across the street. Right. Which is a shame that again they don't put air. I don't know how you guys deal with it with no air conditioning, but
and no smoking.
So, you know, so Charlie, when I talked to Charlie about it, he was like, you may want to just weigh this out with the ROI. And I'm like, it's not worth it. I looked at it right away, and I'm like, I could do it. I could maybe arrange for another place to do it, but then I have this show. I can do it from a studio, and you know, and I don't have everyone distracted with other things to have to get them off the trade show floor across the street.
Yeah, but if you guys could walk around and actually get pictures of products and pictures of the
booth. That's what we need. That's what we need. That's exactly right. What we need. Yes.
Exactly.
Because
opening the like taking the glass cover off of the thing so you guys could get the good picture, that's kind of a pain in the ass in the middle of the trade show.
I hate asking. Right. Usually I just wait for someone to offer because I feel bad, but sometimes I do have to ask, yeah.
If you can get a chance to get it done before, you know, day two or three where everybody's finger fucked the cigars and it's you know the humidity is beating the fuck out of those cigars too, you know.
And well, someone has tried to steal the cigar sample that's glued to the display box.
Yeah, that happened last year. They tried to tear the cigars out of the boxes. We glued them all in.
You know what one really interesting dynamic of the show is that I've found is a lot of the cigars that we put on display are cigars that don't have age on them. So there's cigars that are a couple of weeks old or a month old because they're not going to be smoked. But by the time of the end of the 4 days of sitting in Las Vegas, you know, zero humidity, they're actually great.
Yeah. I got to tell you, since our cigars are glued in, only the top row of the cigars are actually real cigars. Underneath, they're just filler cigars just to make the box look right. So it isn't even a real box of cigars, though.
Yeah, we build like a little shelf inside of the box, so only the top layer.
Because, you know, we cellophane everything but Sin Compromiso, but for the trade show, we uncello everything so retailers can see what the cigars actually look like in the boxes. Mm-hmm. So that those for us, we call them dummy boxes. They're not meant to be smoked. They're only meant to be displayed.
And it's a shame that we actually have to glue these cigars down. We didn't do it for the first couple of years until some asshole took a cigar out of our
box. Yeah, but I'll tell you, here's part of the problem. You don't glue this, like, for example, the boxes are sized to have the cellophane on them. So if you don't glue them in the box is the wrong size. So then the cigars all end up all jumbled up wrong in the box. So to show a box without cello, you end up having to glue the cigars in place or they'll end up being a mess in the box. You really don't have a choice. It isn't just a theft issue. It's an aesthetic issue.
Yeah, we've gone to this. I don't know if you saw this, Coop, but we've made these metal kind of display things where it has all the different Vitolas kind of in one little place instead of showing every box open, which is
– I love that. By the way, I love that. Yes.
Of course, we didn't invent that. People have been doing that for years, but I think we're the first ones to do it like in metal, but it's a lot easier for us to show the whole line of cigars that way, but they're more pilferable because people will take them out of that that metal thing, which is crazy. People tried to steal our Sonos speaker off the wall last year. I mean, really, the biggest theft happens probably by the security guards at night. So
right.
I'm far more concerned about the security guard at night or whoever, the janitor, stealing, you know, a speaker from our booth than I am about losing a few cigars.
I have to be honest with you. I find most of the retailers to be very respectful about it. I don't see retailers don't come into our booth and try to scoop a ton of stuff up.
No, I mean, there's a certain class of retailer that goes into the Phillips and King booth and tries to get everything possible so they can take it back to their store and resell it. But we don't have those. I mean, we have too many eyeballs in our booth.
I also think it's also a different customer class that you're dealing with.
Right, right.
I mean, look, we're all small companies. We all have somewhat of a personal relationship with our retailers. They're making the conscious decision to do business with a small company. You know what I mean? It's a much different relationship with most of the retailers we deal with than when you're P&K. You know what I mean?
Right.
It is different. So I don't like you said, Skip, I find theft after hours is more prevalent. Like the boxes that got destroyed last year, they got destroyed the night before the trade show. Somebody tried to pull cigars out of the boxes. The thing that irritated me about it is after the first one, you think they would have realized that, oh, the cigars are glued in. Why they had to go and do it to so many boxes, I don't understand why.
You know, one of the interesting things is at the end of every show, we always give whatever samples we have left over and all of our display cigars, we give them to Cigars for Warriors. And it'd be interesting this year if with this tax thing, if that's even allowed, because it's not for a commercial purpose. So
I watch our booth like a hawk. I'm not gonna lie.
Hector's like the police when it comes to his samples.
I watch that booth like a hawk. I don't even let them the samples. Can I get four? No, you can get three.
We're pretty generous with samples until we start to run out.
Well,
I mean, ultimately, I want people to try the cigar. I want them to smoke it.
Yeah, but you know Eric, right?
Yes, you know,
earlier. Eric wants people to smoke the cigar, but I remember, you know, we had that special thing that we did last year, that first year of the St. Provincia, and I look over and there's a cigar missing from the box. So I start to lose my shit. How did I miss this? And he goes, oh, I gave it to somebody. Bro, you can't do that. No, we got 19 cigars there. You know,
I'll tell you an interesting kind of thing is if you go around to all the ashtrays, when you start seeing the same three or four new cigars that are kind of 1 inch smoked on them and just thrown in the ashtray, right? That's a good kind of informal, that's not going to be a good cigar.
I don't ever do that. I always take the bands off before I put them in the ashtray.
Do you remember the year Great Wall of China Cigars was there? They left all their cigars lying around when they left the trade show. They just left them and no one took them. No one was taking them.
Right.
Right. It's a true story. True story. True story. So you guys are pretty much saying the media coverage is what it's not too much. Is it too much?
I didn't say anything.
Oh, you didn't? Okay.
No. Let me say this. It is not your fault. Mm-hmm. It's just, I will say this. It does get to be very repetitive sometimes. Because it's the same questions over and over again, so it's hard to be enthusiastic 16 times in a row. And particularly with you guys doing video, I know you don't do any video, Coop, but with everyone doing video, you know,
it's for radio.
It is difficult, particularly when you are so. By the time you get to day three, you're pretty beat up. So that's the only thing. I wish there was more diversity in the questions, but I understand everybody has different audiences and. You have to go through the same dog and pony over and over again, but that's a personal complaint, not something that I think the media is doing wrong.
we've had we've found that there's, I think there's certain media brands that do a good job at covering the personalities and vibe of the show. That's not where my strength I've found is. It's more about the product coverage. And then last year I tried to do something where we tried to find some themes with all the booths, and that was, I found it worked well for us. But, you know, there's other brands that they don't have podcasts and they rely on the video coverage a lot more. You know, and like Stogie Review and Federation have been doing it for years, and they've been very good at it. So I don't know if me doing the same thing is going to accomplish, it's going to take away from what my strength is. And a lot of it too is relationship stuff. We go to the trade show, which is maybe not something that's covered, but it's, I found very important to do that. So that's something that's not necessarily covered, but it builds, like, I know Aaron invests a lot of time with that.
Yeah.
And I think it goes well to build the brand throughout the whole year.
Aaron goes just to say negative shit about La Palina.
I mean, that shit writes itself, man.
I don't know. We got what do you call it? We bumped Cigar Dave last year with La Palina. I couldn't believe it. Cigar Dave, we bumped him out.
Never heard of him. That's still my one of my favorite moments of the trade show is, it was like our third or fourth year, and we were just super, super busy. It was the first year we had the big booth. And I look over from the other side of the booth and I see Cigar Dave like on the edge of the carpet, and he's just like looking in, and you know, he wants to come in and like do what he does, but at the same time, he can't figure out what he's seeing. It's like, who's this company that's so busy, and I never heard of them, and I don't know anything about what they do. And then he just at some point just turned around and walked away. So I was like, it was like a force field of legitimacy that kept Cigar Dave out of our booth.
You think he'll even be at the show this year? I don't even know if he'll attend it.
I think he is going to be there. He's scaled back though on the, doing the shows there. And I know it's a cost thing. I mean, I know a lot of that time was paid time too. Like, people don't realize, you know, the people he has on there, it's paid spots he's doing there. And so I understand.
He had one guy on a few years ago. I don't know if you remember, Coop. He had one guy a few years ago. I think it was like $2,000 for like 10 minutes. Yeah. And he said the guy's name wrong, which is awesome.
I was in a booth when they came there trying to sell a spot to someone. So I know that. But yeah, he's got huge costs to do what he was doing a few years ago. So I'm not exactly I do understand certain
things. Model has always been pay to play.
Yeah.
And look, it's not like he's dishonest about it. It is what it is.
It is what it is, exactly.
His time, he chooses to sell it. He has a rate that he charges. It's a rate that, for me, is just too high. And, you know, it's just look. You have no control over what the media does or does not do. So I don't find it to be something worth really agonizing over. And I think now, because of social media, we all have to a degree the ability to control our own messages. You know what I mean? You don't have to. It's not like it was in the mid-90s where there was essentially one media source. They pretty much dictated the story that got out. They set the standards for everybody. Now you basically have a hodgepodge of people, and you also have the ability to just talk directly with consumers. So for me, I don't it's not something I really think about, to be honest with you. The only thing I do think about is I do like interacting with people and interacting with the media, so I try to make a point of it at the trade show. But controlling the message or who saw you, who didn't sell you, what list you made, what list you didn't make, in the end, you have no real control over it. And the other thing, too, is what consumers have to understand about all the top lists is they always are going to favor the new products. I mean, for some of them, it's because the media, their own individual criteria is that the product must be new. And the other thing too is, look, they're trying to get viewership and readership, and it's much more interesting to read about Baca than it is to read about Intemperance, even though Intemperance is a great cigar. You know what I mean? Because it's new and it's fresh, and you guys are trying to generate traffic for your site. So that's where the focus always ends up being. So it's kind of a chicken or egg kind of situation.
Very good. I agree.
I've already reviewed all of Steve's new products.
all right. Hector and I
were sitting on the porch the other day smoking some of Steve's cigars, giving our tasting notes.
It'll be on a upcoming website that we're putting together.
FTG.com.
Yeah, when do I get my opportunity to complain?
Those Gordos.
I'll give it to you right now. I'll give it to you right now to complain.
Okay. I want to understand, what is your issue with the name Brulee? You've mentioned it three times.
Here we go.
I knew I called it. It was gonna, okay. I have no issue with the name Brulee.
Well, no. You've brought it up three times. And one time you said, if anybody but Steve Sokka did this, do you think they could get away with it?
That's what – okay. It's because I believe – that if someone else, well, because the Brulee obviously has that dessert connotation, right?
All right.
We're in this politically.
Why did you not bring this issue up with like La Creme or with Espinosa Crema or with, Viaje Carolina Reaper? That's named actually directly after a food item where I'm trusting.
Wait, Sokka.
Why is Brulee sticking in your head? But Crema or La Creme, or I think McAuliffe has La Crema coming out this year, which I find really weird because Espinosa, you have a Crema, right, Hector?
He has a what coming out? I'm sorry?
He has La Crema coming out this year. You have Espinosa Crema.
Hold on. Let me write down the time this came on the podcast so I can check with Frank tomorrow. Hold on a second.
McAuliffe has a 2019 release on La Crema. So I'm just trying to understand why companies not warrant this type of scrutiny.
Okay.
Skip. I don't need your opinion.
Wait, brought it up
multiple times.
Skip's opinions on the house.
Tell Sokka, tell him the name of your new one that's named after the Turkish ice cream, and he'll stop talking about Brulee and he'll make fun of that one.
You're right. I have a cigar called Dondurma coming out, and that's named after Turkish ice cream. You're absolutely right. That one's going to be a total disaster.
Yeah, then he'll forget all about Brulee and he'll talk about that one. Yeah.
We're going to release Häagen-Dazs at the show, so hopefully that'll do well.
Go back to it. So why Skip, is Brulee a problem, but Crema isn't a problem?
I don't think either one of a problem, but
I Coop know like, you don't, Skip. You're normal. I want to hear Coop's answer.
Coop likes to call things gimmicky until he's talking to you face-to-face, and then he equivocates and crawfishes on his
opinion. Okay.
Well, you know, Steve, now that I think about it, I think it's okay. You know, I like crumble.
I see what you're trying to do there.
I saw what you were doing. I didn't see it at first, but, you know, I'm good with it.
Now listen, okay? Okay. Steve, yeah. Fair point, okay, but crema and those types of words have been used for a long time, okay? The cream, we've heard these things for a long time.
I'm being accused of being original? That's what I'm going to
do? I think it is original. But if someone else came out with a Brulee cigar that wasn't popular like you are, I think they would get crucified. That's just my opinion.
But why?
Because Steve is a very popular guy.
Yeah, but what is
I love the name. I love the name. I don't hate the name. I love the name.
Just because it's named after dessert.
I don't remember this complaint about Magic Toast. I'm pretty sure toast is actually a food where Brulee basically, you know, Brulee originates from, it means burnt ground. It's used to describe, actually, it's no different than using the word smoked or roasted. It's a style. It's not actually a food. Creme brulee is a food.
People think of it as a dessert. Don't they think of it as a dessert?
Huh?
Don't
people... Look, I would be a moron to say I'm not trying to get the connection.
Right, okay. Fair
because,
enough.
Look, it's a mild, sweeter style cigar. It's what it is.
Right.
So
It's really good.
I'm just trying to understand this selective I think that you are using my popularity to benefit you by choosing to pick a fight that's really unjust.
With a sponsor, no less.
By the way, just so everybody out there knows, I did not write that fucking ad. Okay, because that ad is crazy. I did not write that, okay?
No, it was, he did not, okay?
I did not write that ad. Every time I hear it, I kind of cringe a little.
Okay, we'll go a new one on that. But
well, more importantly, Coop, how do you feel about Tricky Traca?
I like Tricky Traca. I have no idea. It's like, I have no idea what it is. I can't even say it. I can't even say it correctly.
Okay, Coop, how do you feel about fat white guys from New Hampshire naming their products with Spanish names.
He lived in Nicaragua for a while. He spent a good time of his life in Nicaragua.
If by live you mean...
And you too, yeah.
If by live you mean spending 7 days hating every second of it, yes, Saka has lived here.
Yeah, that's part true. You know, over the last 30 years, I've spent 7 cumulative in third world countries. But I'll tell you what,
let me tell you his
name.
Steve, can you tell him what your favorite part of Nicaragua is?
Yes, it's Flight 970. It's AA 970. You know, I'll tell you, but honestly, to answer that question, the reason why I'm like everybody else. I'm a cigar geek, okay? And when I was not in the business, I really identified strongly with a lot of those classic Cuban brands. And so you'll notice there's a couple general themes in my branding. A, I tend to go more on that Spanish culture.
Right.
B, I also tend to go typically with a rather understated look for the most part. I tend to always lean towards the classic. You know, that's just my sense of aesthetics. And you saw that in the products I developed when I was at Drew Estate. And you see it in the products I'm still developing today. Ultimately, like, I look at other people's products like Black Label or Warp, and I could admire the work that they put into it from a brand packaging and a naming perspective, but it isn't my personal sense of aesthetics. You know what I mean? So for me, the brands are a representation of who I am. And that's where my comfort zone is. I, you know, maybe someday I'll change it up. I don't know. And what I want to know is also, how can Skip get away with using my name on a product? Do I have any legal grounds there?
It's Baca.
That culture existed, Steve. That culture existed about 25,000 years
ago. I looked it up right away, man. I know. Pygmies are called Baca. I checked it out. It's actually an interesting name. It's an interesting project.
And I thought it fit in. I thought it fit in with that, you know, that, you know.
No, it fits in with his scheme. I mean, he does Neanderthal. He does Aquitaine, Cro-Magnon. So it actually makes sense in the way he chooses to position and brand his products. I have no freaking clue what Espinosa is doing. It's all over the place. We got Laranja. We got Chroma. We got the psychedelic LSD Turtle. We got all sorts of crazy
bro. Alpha We're dog. Selling cigars.
I'm just waiting.
We're selling cigars, bro. I got to sell cigars. All right?
Bro. When are you going to come out with a product called Bro?
I'm waiting for Bill and Juan to come out with Central Park 5.
Yeah. Oh. There you go.
You're on, Skip's on that Central 5. Skip, he's on that thing right now.
No, I like the theme in Protocol, for example. I think it's the most – I like the consistency of the house of those brands, right? Is they're kind of all
law enforcement oriented, sure.
Right. I like that.
I was surprised that they knew what Themis was. That kind of blew me away.
That's courtesy of Google. There's no way. Yeah.
Actually, my whole favorite part of this so far has been when Aaron took sides with us against you, Coop. So I'm just going to go ahead.
Aaron always takes sides against me.
I have no problem.
I didn't know he was such a salty fuck. Aaron.
This is the primetime show. There's no holds barred with the hosts here. They can come after. So I'm gonna.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
So any more comments about Brulé, or are you going to go?
Yeah, I'm going to say this because maybe – okay. I still believe what I just said about the Brulé, but I think it's in Steve's defense, I did single him out. So I'm going to do a little bit of an observation at the trade show this year of names that I think people are – possibly maybe they get away with, and I'll come back after the trade show with some of these.
Here's the thing that I think everybody wants to know.
Okay. Medium Roast Cafe. There's a ton of these foods.
It's fair. Yeah. No, I think I picked on you unfairly, Steve. I do. But
what's the issue? Is it just that things that are named after food? Like, what's the issue? What's the real issue?
Well, we're in this, like, PC culture today. You know, like I'm going back when, like, you know, go back with the Chinese finger trap, you know, when – you know, I know that was a cigar that came out of your factory.
I had an issue because of the toy.
I think that's what it is, Steve. I think what it is you had an issue with the cigar, so now he's gonna like
more okay.
critical of you when you.
I don't think that fits
that mold.
Look, if you can call a cigar pickle juice, then everything is on the table.
Exactly.
And God, we got nugs, right?
And if you can find let me tell you something. Say what you want. If you can find the pickle juice anywhere, I mean, those things pull out of there.
Okay, I got to
confess. Sometimes gimmick works, bro. What are you going to do?
Yeah. So I'm going to do that.
So
I'm gonna,
here's
– Yeah, so, I'm going
to – So, ahead, Coop, sorry.
No, go
so
ahead.
So here's the interesting thing before we move past Brulee, right? So I've had
this, I knew this was coming.
I want your opinion on this because this is my observation as a consumer, right?
Okay.
So Steve came to me, said, "Hey, try this thing. You know, it's fresh. It's you know, but it's this new thing I'm working on." Immediately, it's this rich kind of. It's a very hard cigar to make in Nicaragua, in my opinion. Being a guy who makes cigars in Nicaragua and knowing the tobaccos that they have over there, I was really impressed with what Steve accomplished with it. But then we got into this discussion about, okay, everybody, like if I came out with a cigar like that, it's not necessarily a cigar. Steve's opinion is it's not necessarily a cigar that my consumers would smoke because they're looking for heavier, stronger cigars. And there wouldn't be a market for it the same way kind of Padron had a hard time selling their Connecticut, right? For a whole lot of other reasons. My opinion back to Steve was I have a tray full of every kind of great, you know, good heavy Nicaraguan cigars. I find myself digging to try to and going to find good, mild, you know, cigars that you can just like sessionable for lack of a better word cigars, and this hits a spot that's underserved in his line and my line and in Nicaraguan cigars in general. So Steve's feeling is you know, of course the way Steve always says it is, I love it, it's the greatest thing, but no one's gonna smoke it. It won't sell. Right, but I think it will, because I think there's people who smoke heavy cigars who also like who have this kind of gap in the products that are available to them of really, really good tobacco. And
it's not that I don't think it won't sell. It's going to sell. But what I'm saying about that market segment is the consumers that smoke milder Connecticut shades tend to be consumers that are very locked into the legacy brands. They're a very, very tough market to get into. They're so used to smoking Monte Cristo White, Romeo Julieta Reserva Real, and you know, Oliva Connecticut's. It's a tough look. And we had this experience when I was at Drew with Chateau Real,
was a good Real cigar.
It was a very good cigar, yep. But you know, it's very tough to penetrate those particular consumers. And the other thing too is, I mean, it's really kind of a cigar that's really competing against very few, because it's kind of the quality level of an Ashton Cabot or a Diamond Crown or a Davidoff style cigar. And there's not a lot of those guys at that price point. It's not like it's a great Connecticut for $6. It isn't. You know, it's a great Connecticut for $12, $13. So you've got a very limited pool of people that, you know, that I think – I honestly don't know. I mean, I have retailers telling me that they think they're going to do fantastic with it. They know their consumers better than I do. I know that from my personal point of view – one of my favorite cigars that Nicholas has made was his original High Clear Castle in the Connecticut shade. I was very impressed with that cigar. And I know there's some retailers that do really well with it, but I know other retailers, you know, it's a little bit more difficult sell for them. You know, it's a tougher market to get into. And the other thing too is I know that most of the social media posts center around stronger cigars. And you don't see a lot of pictures of people that are active on social media smoking milder Connecticut shade style cigars. So you're pretty much saying to yourself, hey, I'm not going to get that extra bit of free advertising that I would get. Tricky Traca, I think that's going to float a lot of guys' boats that are my consumers. Personally, I find the Tricky Traca to be a little bit overwhelming. It's not a cigar that I can smoke 7 or 8 of them a day. It's a cigar that I smoke when I'm like, okay, I just really smoked the cigar and I need to take a sip back. You know, but I just know it's a difficult segment to penetrate, and it's much more difficult as a small company. And I know that Drew Estate didn't see success with it until they got to rebite at the apple with Underground Shade. And at that point, they were a much larger company with a much larger consumer base, whereas compared to the experience that we have with Chateau Real. You know, so this, I'm just thinking about it from the grand scheme of things. But ultimately, as you well know, we never really know what's going to be successful or what isn't going to be successful. I mean, we all make things with the intent of, wow, we did everything we could to make it the best possible. But what consumers ultimately end up adopting or not adopting long-term is, it's impossible to guess. I do know that, yes, a lot of people are going to try it. I know it's going to sell very well initially. The question is, will it be on the trajectory of the other brands where, hey, 2-3 years from now, I'm saying, oh, this is something that's got some legs, it has a possibility of continuing, or will it end up being kind of more of a flash in the pan? And I don't know that answer. I just know it's a more difficult competitive market that's pretty much locked up by the legacy guys. It just is.
In fairness to everyone on the panel, because I picked on Steve, I picked on Skip last year, I did pick on Hector with one release this year.
Which one was that?
Hush Money.
Oh, bro, don't even talk
to you. So I did pick on him. I did pick on that one too. So I did. I think I. But I to answer, go back to Steve's. I'm actually going to go through that because I think I did single Steve out a little unfairly, and I'll come up with that.
Oh, list I love after. It actually. Heck, you know.
I love it too. The people still talk about that interview I did with you when you went after me about the Chinese finger trap. It was great.
Look, I mean, and in the end, it's just a point of a. It's just an opinion.
Right.
There's no right or wrong right. to any of these things.
Yeah.
You could probably surmise that it helped. It actually helped those guys. You know. Did you see what Saka said? Next thing you know, right. I'm telling you, that was one of the fastest selling cigars that the factory ever put out.
All right. You know, we lost Saka there. So what I'm going to do?
Is there anything? Is there really any bad press?
No, there isn't. There isn't. But I think I just chased Steve away. What I'll do is you guys aren't going to be here super late. So I'm going to do one more round of commercial. We'll get into our last few segments here.
Coos Lion, you'll be here late.
Well, that's up to them.
He's got a box, bro. He's got a box.
All right.
Props.
So let's.
Props.
All right.
Props.
All right. All right, so want to mention our sponsors, J.C. Newman Cigar Company. Founded in 1895 by Julius Caesar Newman, J.C. Newman is the oldest family-owned premium cigar maker in America. For 4 generations and 124 years, J.C. Newman has been handcrafting many of the world's finest cigars. J.C. Newman is headquartered in an iconic 109-year-old cigar factory in the Ybor City National Historic Landmark District of Tampa, Florida. At this factory, known as El Rojo, J.C. Newman rolls premium cigars by hand and hand-operated antique machines. The J.C. Newman Pensa factory is the second largest in Nicaragua, and it's where Brick House, Perla del Mar, El Baton, and Quorum cigars are hand-rolled. J.C. Newman's Diamond Crown, Maximus, Julius Caesar, and Black Diamond are handmade by Tabacalera A. Fuente in the Dominican Republic. With its longtime partners, the Arturo Fuente family, the Newmans have founded the Cigar Family Charitable Foundation, which supports low-income families in the Dominican Republic with education, healthcare, vocational training, and clean water. Visit jcnewman.com to learn more. And by M. Bombay Cigars represent the most admired cigar culture of Cuba. They select the best of the best quality tobacco to use in the aging process. M. Bombay Cigars are enrolled in Costa Rica by some of the world's most experienced cigar rollers, giving it a unique smoking experience. The band portrays the detailed and artistic nature of our small industry. Try M. Bombay and the new Gaia line and the new M. Cuba line. Okay, Gaia line and the new M. Cuba line. M. Bombay Cigars, where the cigars are a way of life. And by Caldwell Cigar Company. Caldwell Cigar Company launched in 2014 with a very simple mantra: create, innovate, ambition. Since day one, they have done things differently. They have challenged the industry norms that produce sticks that time and time again deliver on their promise. Look for Caldwell products or any number of their collaborations at your local retailer today. And by Casa Cuevas Cigars. The Cuevas family has 4 generations of experience in cigar making. For many years, they have manufactured cigars for many industry leaders out of their Las Lavas factory in the Dominican Republic. Now with Casa Cuevas, the Cuevas family brings their very own brand to market. Try the Casa Cuevas Connecticut, Habano, and Maduro, as well as the recently released Prensado and limited edition Flaco line extensions. If they don't carry it, be sure to ask your local retailer for Casa Cuevas cigars. Casa Cuevas cigars, from our casa to your casa. You know, I always mention the Cattle Baron cigars and meat. I just want to ask a question here. We were talking about this before the pregame show as far as food goes. Steve, the competition with Abe and Nimish, you were talking about it before the show. Where do you think you're going to lie with this? People want to know. It's the the decision's coming, I guess, the end of the month, who wins this diet contest.
I think that Nimish is already over the threshold. I think Abe is like very close to the threshold. And I'm close to, I'm only about 7 pounds away, but I've really struggled over the last 30 days. I've been pretty much on a plateau.
Steve, in all fairness, you do look a lot leaner. I mean, I'll be honest with you, it paid off.
I'm still a very fat bastard. I'm just a little less fat of a bastard. But and the other thing too is I'm looking forward to hitting the goal and then just kind of continuing but not trying to be as aggressive about it. I'd like to have the opportunity to play around a little bit more, but the time constraints have made it impossible. And I'd like to get back to where I'm lifting, but the problem is if I lift, I end up needing at least 2,500 to 3,000 calories a day or I'm just starving. And I've been very reluctant to do it because, you know, I did it for about 2 weeks and I actually found that I was gaining weight as a result. And I'm like, okay, well, I can't do this. So I'm currently on the Ganji diet right now.
The Ganji diet.
Yeah, water and water only. Yeah, it's pretty depressing.
You know, with the one event I saw you eating celery sticks at, you were really serious about it.
Yeah, look, I've taken 15% in 4 months is a lot. I'm down, I guess as of this morning, I'm down 53 pounds in like 3 months and a week, 3 months and 2 weeks. It's a lot of weight. It really is. It's a little too aggressive, but it's good. You know, it's something that I've needed to do for a very, very long time.
Well, good for you. I mean, I think I think all three of you guys, Abe's also been working very hard at it too. So I saw some of the bird food he was eating. And so, I mean,
Abe went like all liquid.
I would have wore a dress. That's just my opinion. I would have worn a dress and eat that stuff. I'm having a
legs for it, Coop. You don't have a legs for it.
It was like blended kale, I think, is what it was. It was all this like green goop and a sludge in a cup.
All right. One question I have for you guys, trade show wise, and then Aaron, we can move on to, I guess, the segment you have. What is your worst horror story from the trade show? Give me a horror story that was just like a nightmare that you guys have had.
Well, 1 year, we had the guy who stole a cigar, and I was still new in this. I was like, it was our second show, and some guy stole a cigar. And I saw who it was, and I chased him into the next booth, and I started yelling at this guy. I mean, just yelling at this guy. And everybody, people were like shrugging, so he took a cigar. And still, it was the principle of the matter. But that wasn't the worst story. The worst story was our first year.
Oh, I know this one.
Yeah, our second year. That was our third year. Our second year, some guy took the bomb.
The bomb.
Another manufacturer came by and said, "Hey man, you know, I like that bomb that you guys have here. I'm thinking about taking it tonight and taking pictures all over the floor show with it." And I said, "I didn't know who he was. I knew who he was, but I didn't know him." So I said, "Yeah, I don't think that's a good idea." He goes, "Oh, I'm really good friends with Eric," and I told him, "I really don't think that's a good idea." So when I get to the booth the next day, I'm the first one there, and the bomb's missing. So I call Eric and, "Hey, the bomb's missing." And so I go straight to this guy's booth and I tear this booth like the DEA looking for drugs. I just toss this whole booth. Girl comes in. "Can I help you?" I said, "Where is this guy?" "Oh, he'll be here. You make sure he brings his ass to our booth." So in the meanwhile, we found out that Nimish had taken the bomb and walked it over to Rocky's booth. And while we find that out, the guy comes over and he's, "Hey guys, I heard you guys. I didn't take the bomb. I swear, I promise." And by then we knew who he was, and we were like, "All right, you know, you didn't know how close you were to getting your ass beat at the IPCPR." But when Eric found out it was Nimish, the security guards didn't take it as the joke that it was meant to be, because they spent a good 45 minutes to an hour. They were going to go look at videotape and all this other shit. And then when we found out who it was, Eric told the guy, "Hey, it was this guy. It was a joke. He's friends of ours." But they went over there and hassled Nimish. And as I told Nimish later that day, I said, "Had you been in Miami, you'd have gone to jail. We'd at least handcuffed you. We'd at least handcuffed you and made it a bigger show." But that was the worst. That was the hardest part for me because, like I said, I really don't deal. I don't deal with the customers or the clients or anything. But as a the fact that they took something from our booth, especially after you know the first marching orders we ever got at the show were: if you go to somebody's booth, don't touch shit. Don't even admire the booth, look around, but don't touch anything. So we kind of expected that also at our booth, and it didn't happen that day because, you know, some guys had relationships, you know, that go back years and years, like Mimish did with Eric. But some shit isn't funny, you know. And I don't have my sense of humor is not as defined as it is now, obviously. So I was pretty pissed off about that. That was a bad moment for me.
I remember that. I can't remember that was the year Warhead launched.
Yeah.
Yep, I do remember that. Okay, Skip Sokka, do you have a horror story to tell?
Last year was probably the roughest for us because of all the problems that were going on in Nicaragua. You know, we generally air freight everything through Miami, and we were on like the edge of not having a single cigar show up for the trade show floor. So we actually got them to actually start putting up to display about 30 minutes before the trade show opened. So that was kind of a stressful. I yelled at a lot of people that day.
It wasn't when the Romacraft party got shut down?
No. The funny thing about the Romacraft party is the first night they shut it down because of the dojo party. I'm going to blame them because – because they were like right down the hall from us, and we'd been doing this for a couple of years and never had an issue. I mean, they've told us to hold it down and whatever, but some people from the dojo party kind of migrated over to the porch, to the patio next to them.
Put on those old ladies.
And there was like two old ladies there who kept calling security, and so they shut that party down, and then they came down to us and shut us down. So the second night, it was getting late. It was like midnight or something, and I was just worn out. And the cop came in and was like, "Hey, we threw you guys out last night. We don't want to throw you out. We caught a lot of heat over it, but please turn it down." And so I went to the DJ. I'm like, "Look, turn it up. Maybe they'll shut this thing down and we'll get to go to bed." so we intentionally turned it up, and they came back in and was like, "Look, we don't want to throw you out, but why did you turn the music up?" And then we turned it up again. And then they're like, "If we have to come back, we're going to have to throw you out." And I'm like, "Oh, please don't." So we kind of instigated the second night of getting thrown out.
Was that the night of the perp walk picture?
No, that was the action. That was the first night. Skip? That was when we were really getting thrown out.
That's a great picture.
I got more questions about that picture. I remember what happened.
Yeah, that was, When our DJ started playing "Fuck the Police," that was the final straw.
Oh man! Come on, man!
By the way, Skip, I got a confession to make. I did not know what CREAM was originally. I just thought it was something like CYOP with crown heads. I didn't realize there was a connotation to hip hop with that till like in the last few months. Just so you know that.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, I just wanted – no, I figured you were going to say that too.
When I think hip-hop, I think Will Cooper. I mean, you know. Yeah.
Who is Rick Ross?
Will still thinks the Wu-Tang Clan is a gang from
East
Harlem.
East L.A. Yeah.
All right. Sokka, what about you? You got to have a horror story.
No, there's so many over the years. I mean, I've been involved in major lawsuits at the trade show. I mean, things that have just exploded. I mean, we've had, you know, there's been times where booths haven't gotten delivered. We had one trade show where a consumer thought it would be funny to drive the donk away. So the donk just disappeared out of in front of the building. I mean, I had one circumstance where we had a guy arrested for an alleged rape. I mean, it's,
what?
Yeah.
Wow.
You win.
Look, it's been 20. Been 25 years of trade.
You win.
Wow.
I mean, it's horror. I got to be honest with you. Things have gone really smooth over the last couple, 3 years. So, I mean, we've had a few things broken here and there. But, yeah, there have been some doozies. And most of them don't – I don't even want to think about them. I'm getting a little depressed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
You think you have problems with your bomb? Wait till a guy gets arrested for underage sex.
That's why I went first, because I knew he was going to fuck us up at the end with that story. You goddamn it, Steve. You know. All right.
Steve,
I can tell you the
real problem.
I'll tell you when I was the angriest at a trade show. There was one particular cigar manufacturer that was going around telling other retailers that they were actually the blender and creator of Liga Privada. And I got so hot, I actually had to leave the building because I just wanted to beat the living shit out of that fuck. And the only thing that worked to my advantage is I went over to Caesars and I managed to win $22K at the casino because I was just so steamed. I had to walk out of the building because I literally wanted to beat the living fuck out of him. And see, Coop, he knows it. He knows what a scumbag he is. As a result, even to this day, he pretty much avoids me for the most part.
Stolen valor, Coop. Stolen valor is an issue, bro.
It's a cigar, isn't it?
Unstolen.
No,
oh, unstolen. Okay.
Taking credit for that's bullshit. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. With soccer, yeah. Okay, soccer, that was a good one. One last question on the just trade show stuff. Any other releases that we didn't hit tonight that you guys want to mention that we didn't mention tonight that you guys have coming out of the trade show?
What do you have coming out, Hector?
Well, let's see. We've had a pretty we've had a busy year, as you can tell. We had that collaboration with the dojo right before last week while I was in Nicaragua. So until I landed, I didn't know that they had gone through them all. And I think Abe's not going to the show. And I think Abe not going to the show kind of coincides with his microblend release. We're doing a cigar for him.
That's a good cigar. I had a chance to smoke it. It was a good cigar.
Yeah, we did the second iteration of that Bunker Buster in Connecticut. It's round. It's not box pressed. But at the show, we're doing the second iteration of La Seis Provincia. We're doing Warhead 5. And I guess the national showing of Oscuro. Even though we launched Oscuro a couple of months, maybe 6 weeks ago, we had just noticed that they're really, I think as the show was earlier this year, a lot of people haven't been a lot of releases. So we kind of took a risk there. We kind of gambled that, hey, let's go ahead and let's release this. And hopefully, since there's not a lot of cigars out there that are being reviewed right now, maybe we can get some good reviews leading into the show. And we've been very lucky. It's a great cigar. And I think it's gonna draw people to the. It's gonna help, you know. Besides the fact that Eric is a draw, that cigar is gonna draw.
That Oscuro is under the Laranja line, correct, Hector?
Yes, sir. It's a Laranja. It's in the Laranja line with a dark Modafina wrapper, and I think that's gonna attract some people. Outside of the fact that Eric's an attraction anyway, we're gonna get people at the booth, and we have a couple of line extensions on Murciélago. And maybe something else that we'll have for the show if time works for us, you know, because this is a little earlier than last year's and the year. And I think it wasn't the first one 7 or 8 years ago. Wasn't it in August?
The Orlando one was in August.
Yeah. I remember my first show was in August, and it's incrementally gotten closer and closer. I mean,
really we've always asked for. We've always asked for the show to be earlier.
Yeah, but June and August, there's no difference. It's 106 degrees today in Las Vegas. It's Death Valley days, bro.
But from a business point of view, June is better than August.
Okay.
So, I mean, look, ideally, I mean, if I could pick my druthers, I'd rather have the show in, like, end of March, early April. That would be the ideal time frame. I don't know if they'll ever be able to march the date back that far. And I also don't think that they will because of the – it will overlap with the TAA, and I don't think it's in the TAA members' best interest to have the show significantly earlier either. So,
when does it start getting cool in Vegas?
Vegas starts getting kind of nice at the end of October, November.
When Coop steps off the airplane.
I'm flying this year.
Nobody's gonna want to go in October to the show. It's, you know, don't you think? Or do you think October?
No, October's a terrible time of year because then you're releasing the products into the dead of winter. That's not good. That's why at April time frame and end of March, early April is almost perfect. Because it's just when the bulk of the retailers are starting to get into their best selling season. So that would be ideal. But look, you know, I'm used to look, we're in the cigar industry. Ideal never seems to be a reality. So
very good. Very good. Anything else, guys?
What do you have coming out this year, Skip?
So the big one is Baca. So Baca is not a part of our core line. It's a new thing we're doing where we've had the concept and the branding for all of the Cro-Magnon sizes, all seven, but we're going to only release two a year based on the size of the Cameroon that we can get. So this year we're releasing two sizes, the 4x46 and the 4.5x52. There's 1,000 boxes of each, so that's going to go pretty fast. We're actually shifting our focus, the way we sell Cro-Magnon. Instead of taking orders from everybody and just shipping first come first serve, we're going to start allocating every shipment as it comes in. The same way, kind of VSG or Opus X or those kinds of things are allocated. So we're going to do that with Baca and with Cro-Magnon. The other new things we're doing this year is we have a line extension for Guaymaro, which is the Rothschild, which is really good. We have the limited edition for Paustania, the War Bear, the
Woj Tick. What's the size of the War Bear?
5x50 short perfecto.
Oh, I have one of those that he gave me. I was actually going to post a picture and said, what exactly is this? But now I know. Good.
Yeah. So, and then we also have the Fiorella, which is the Grand Corona size of the Wonderlust, which is a little bit different blend than the Wonderlust. That's a limited release for Solid Delay in Germany at Intertobac. So, you know, we don't do new stuff, and we did Cro-Magnon in 2010, and Temperance in 2012, Aquitaine 2011. Then we didn't do anything new until Neanderthal, and then we did Wonderlust and Whiskey Rebellion. So I know it doesn't seem like it, but we've been doing this now for 9 years, and you know we kind of average a release every year and a half or so, every, you know, 1 or 2 years. So, and then those lines just kind of sustain. So we can't produce any more cigars. So sometimes, for example, when right now we're waiting on the broadleaf, as you know, Steve, which maybe is something we could talk about in a minute, but, we're waiting on the broadleaf. And then, so we had extra capacity in the factory. That's why we did more Baca and these other two sizes, but that capacity won't necessarily be there next year. So it's not something we can guarantee we can do, you know, kind of we can't commit to a new core line. We haven't committed to a new core line since the single size of Neanderthal 5 years ago. So.
Steve, did we miss anything from you?
No, I'm going to do Sober Mesa Brulee in three sizes. And then I'm going to do Treaky Traca in two sizes. I was going to show Unstolen Valor at the trade show, but I have so much continued demand for that dopey Lancero. I'm just going to do more. I have more Lanceros actually already made. Then I'm going to save the Unstolen Valor for probably next spring. I don't know whether I'll show a box or not show a box. I hadn't really decided. It's kind of one of those things I'm excited about it because I want Raul to show off his stuff. But at the same time, do you really want to take the focus on something that really isn't going to be available for another 9 or 10 months away from the things that are going to be more available in the near term? And I know this is an issue for all of us, and I'm struggling with this now. I've been pretty much generating a new brand every year since the inception of the company. But this may be the last year because I'm getting to the point now where I feel like the portfolio is going to be very rounded out by adding Brulee, which is at the lower end strength-wise and that mild Connecticut, and then with Tricky Traca being on the very heavy side and the super dark. I feel like I've hit most of the notes that make the most sense. So I don't really see us look, I could change my mind, but I don't really see us generating a lot more brands at this point. I think it's more about solidifying what we have, continuing to make it consistently, you know, fulfilling the promises to the retailers. So I think it's one of those things that this may be, I have another project that is more of a Raul project than a me project, that if I do something, that's probably what we'll actually end up doing for next year. And the other thing too is, you know, you get to a certain size brand portfolio wise, and look, all the retailers only have so much shelf space and they're only going to dedicate so much of it to Roma Craft and so much to Espinosa and so much to Dunbarton. You're almost in some way starting to cannibalize your own stuff. And that's something that really doesn't really do any of us any good. So it's really more focusing on, you know, quality and consistency and you know, expanding what you have. I think that's kind of where my head is at right now. But
well, one thing new we all three have this year is, so we all three have new salespeople. So Eric has Jack Tarano this year. You've got Dave Lafferty, and we added John D'Oliver from Zycar. So that's one kind of interesting thing, is that all three of our companies have kind of expanded from that perspective. So it'll change the dynamic at the show for us, and in the sense of having more coverage.
Right.
So that's a good thing.
Let me ask though, is that's Jack really a value add, Hector?
Huh? I'm sorry?
Jack really a value add, or is it really just
horse and cart? I was just going to say that the over and under was 5 for Jack being mentioned, but it was only the first time we mentioned him, and we're 2 hours and a half in. Jack's been a boon for us. He's been
– love you, Jack.
And he's not watching. It's 12:30. I don't know if he's watching. He'll watch it tomorrow. But Jack's been great for us. It gives us a presence. You know, he knows a lot of people in the industry. He's very well liked. And he'll be big at our booth. I'm expecting great things. And he's shown great things in the months that he's been with us, you know. It's another character outside of Eric. A completely different guy. But fantastic for us. I'm very happy. I'm very excited about his signing coming on with us. So
you're supposed to now say something nice about Lafferty because of this spiel.
Yeah, you got it now. So how about John? Tell me about, you know, how's Lafferty gonna work out for you?
Okay. All right. So all right. Skip back. You get the segue into the last serious topic we have, and I have one question for everyone at the end. Aaron, I'm going to let you take this part over here because this was your brainchild, and I think it ties onto what Skip was just talking about.
Yeah, so it was a topic that kind of came up in the chat room last week, and that was kind of around tobacco sourcing. I know that's kind of a big topic right now, and it kind of maybe ties in with you know, the difficulties of bringing you know, blends fully baked to market. And maybe into some of the price increases that are getting announced like that. So, I mean, we got guys that can talk to that. So, Skip, I don't know if you wanted to jump in on that, but what's the current state of sourcing tobacco for your products?
So, I think we're all three similar in the sense that none of the three of us grow tobacco. None of the three of us actually have a lot of pre-industry. I think maybe Lizona has a little bit. We have a little bit, we do Atapuraca over five, six years. So that's about the only thing that we really manage our own pilones for. So we're dependent on the market. And so, you know, we have very specific types of tobacco that we use. And we have a very specific kind of Esteli Ligero, for example. And so for our first 3 or 4 years, we were buying Esteli Ligero from Fido Olivas. Fido Olivas has no longer existed. That farm, those farms in Regadillo, they don't even grow tobacco there anymore. So we had to get a new source for that kind of Esteli Ligero. We use a tobacco called Pueblo Nuevo that was never very popular, but as it moved from Fido Olivas to Nica Prosa or Prosignixa, actually, Renee at Prosignixa actually has that project now. More people have started to use it, and so we've had to be more, you know, the way we buy tobacco is we go and look at it. Every year we go and look at it. And there's 50,000 pounds, 100,000 pounds, however much there is, there's this much of it that meets the criteria that we have. We go through all of that. We pick out the stuff that's likely to be the stuff we are going to need. We put it into pilones. For probably 80% of our tobacco, we select raw. And when I say we, I mean Esteban. And then as it comes out of the pilone, for example, broadleaf, we'll pick out, if there's 5,000 pounds, we'll pick out 5,000. If there's 12,000, we'll pick out 12,000. If there's 1,200, we'll pick out all 1,200. And then we put it into a pilone. And then at the end of the process of the pilone, we get a second kind of pass at it where we only have to buy the stuff that actually still meets our requirements after that process. Some of the timelines on that stuff, like Arapiraca, is, like I said, 5 or 6 years. Some of the fillers are 2 to 3 years. Some of the fillers, like Jalapa Seco, are like what was last year, right? And as soon as it comes out of the pilone, it's ready for us to use. But what's happened is, as companies like AJ, for example, is just an easy example. AJ grows a lot of his own tobacco, and he sells some of his tobacco. But AJ makes so many different kinds of cigars, and he's picking up new projects all the time, that he becomes like a new consumer of a kind of tobacco he wasn't a consumer of last year. Mm-hmm. And so when Plasencia does something new, or when STG does something new, you introduce a new kind of player in the market with a lot of capital, right? And so what happens is now it's just more and more people trying to get the same thing. And so we're really fortunate that we have the relationships that we have, but what this translates to for us is not necessarily less availability. It's more the price goes up, and we have to be ready to buy it when they want to sell it. So if I go, used to be, I could go pick out Ecuador Habano for Aquitaine. I could go pick out 25,000 pounds and then buy it 5,000 pounds a month if I wanted to do that. Now, maybe I can get 16,000 pounds if I need it. But if I'm not ready to buy it as soon as it comes off the truck, even 6-8 months before it's even ready, if I'm not ready to pay 100% for it, it'll get sold to someone else. Mm-hmm. So tobaccos we used to pay $4 or $5 a pound for, now we're paying fillers. There's some fillers that are up in the $9-$10 a pound. That's double, right? And then there's some wrappers, even though the prices haven't changed so much, the yields out of those tobaccos are not as good as they used to be because the sort is a little more liberal than it used to be. That's why when we buy Ecuador Habano now, what we used to buy is just for Aquitaine, but we were yielding out so much kind of cleaner wrapper, ironically, that we came up with Whiskey Rebellion because that wrapper didn't really fit Aquitaine. So it's why we've built our product. Like, for example, Guaymaro, once we secured our San Andreas supply chain, we have this Arapiraca that yields off of Intemperance that we use for the binder on Guaymaro, or the broadleaf that we yield off as binder we use on Neanderthal. So, but then there's some really specific kinds of tobacco, like the Pennsylvania Double Ligero, where a company like GK used to sell that to us. We were the first people to really start buying that and using it for filler. And GK doesn't exist in Nicaragua anymore. That's now an Oliva factory. They've moved back to the Dominican. So Esteban, who doesn't like to travel, he goes to the Dominican. He goes to Brazil. In fact, he travels a lot with Raul. So when Raul goes to buy tobacco for Noxa, Esteban's usually with him, and we buy him at the same time and, you know, share shipping logistics and other things. But it's just harder and harder to find specific kinds of tobaccos, which is, you know, sometimes when lines disappear, it's not because that company isn't selling them. It's because they can no longer make the cigar. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we come out with a new cigar, like Baca, you come out with it and you say, hey, we're going to make it when we can make it, how many we can make. But when you came out with a line like Neanderthal, or when you come out with a line like Cro-Magnon or Sober Mesa or Mi Querida or Naranja, you have to really say, lock in the supply chain, buy for a couple of years before you really start marketing the cigar, and then buy ahead when you can so that you can make sure you can consistently make that cigar over time. And like Steve said, you can never really predict how many you're going to sell. For us, we've never had a problem selling everything we make. But let's say, for example, you're a company like Scandinavia, and you go out and you buy $3 million worth of a tobacco for Amazon Basin, for example, which is a very specific kind of tobacco. If that project doesn't work out, you're stuck with $2 million worth of Amazon Basin tobacco, right? So it's not like any other business I've ever been in. When I was in supply chain before, I was dealing with stuff all over the world. But you knew that if you built a new chassis for a new product and you had 6,000 SKUs in that, there were people lined up at the door to make those things. And while from time to time there were shortages of things like LCD panels, someone somewhere was going to build a plant to make more of them if there was a demand for it. Mm-hmm. With tobacco, you're dealing with things like broadleaf, for example. You know, some years there's a lot of broadleaf. There's always a lot of broadleaf, but there isn't. Some years half of it's hail damaged. It's all thin. Maybe binder quality, and the kind of broadleaf that we use, sometimes there's literally less than 5,000 pounds of it, and sometimes there's, you know, 18,000 pounds of it. So, when you've got to buy $200,000-$300,000 worth of broadleaf in 1 year, which I would, if somebody has that to sell right now, I'll buy it tonight. but then people go, oh well. You know, you're not planning correctly. You're not, you know, people like David Garofalo has made the comment a few times as an example who, you know, well, you're not planning properly. It's like, I'm completely at the, I have plenty of money in the bank. You tell me where to buy it, I'll go buy it right now. But I make 250, 300,000 Cro-Magnons a year. And if I have trouble doing, and then you hear all the releases information like so-and-so is coming out with a new broadleaf cigar. So-and-so is coming out with a new broadleaf cigar. It's like, how the fuck are they doing that?
Right.
Because I know the guy who knows every single guy on the planet who grows U.S. Connecticut broadleaf tobacco, and they're not growing more of it. So they're taking that from somebody else who's not able to sell it,
but a lot of it does come down to relationship. You know that, Skip.
Yeah, I mean, we benefit from that, as you know.
We do benefit from it, but, you know, there's like right now, I happen to be one of the few guys that has an adequate source of broadleaf. But a lot of that comes from, I was able, because of the people that I particularly work with, and it's not just a tobacco relationship, it's another relationship that extends further, where there's other people that are scrambling from broadleaf. And, you know, part of it is too, you know, when it comes to tobacco, I mean, you know, I don't own any farms, but there's some crops that I actually commission that are grown exclusively, like the Cultivo Tonto crop or like the Pueblo Nuevo that I get now that it's under Nicoprosa. It makes my life much easier. But originally when it was through GK, I was getting it from an independent farmer. I have a particular tobacco I get out of Jalapa from a farm, Angelica, that, you know, I have a commission structure with that. So, it's just, it is very,
that's,
it's very,
that's
up and down, because you have so many different things. You have environmental concerns, you have individual crop cycle concerns, you have, you know, the broadleaf is particularly troublesome because broadleaf is a crop that doesn't store well long term. It's not like a lot of other wrapper tobaccos where you can bale age it and set it aside. It's tobacco that pretty much, once it's fermented, it's in your best interest to utilize it in the near term. It tends to, you know, get stem rot, stem mold over time. It's not like, you know, an Ecuador Habano or a Ecuador Connecticut that you can put in a bale and it's just going to be fine. Broadleaf is not a very baleable product. You know, so it's always a difficult challenge. And the other thing too is, to a degree, there's always a limit on everything. I mean, every cigar that all of us make, there is a certain top end capacity. I mean, if it's not in Skip's case, it's also just a tobacco capacity he has to worry about, but he also has a production capacity that he has to worry about. I don't have the production capacities that Skip has. But look, I have a top end. I mean, there's a point where I'm going to run out like some other people, but I don't know when that'll happen or if it'll ever happen. And the thing is, you know, there's certain materials that are proving difficult, but across the board, we've all experienced significant increases in the prices on the tobacco end. It's probably the one largest driving factor that's affecting the prices in Nicaragua is the prices of the tobacco. And tobacco is very closely tied to the energy market. So, and it always lags. So those energy hits that we were taking 2-3 years ago, price point wise, you're now seeing the prices reflect in tobacco from those. And the other thing too is, even though right now the energy costs are down, it's very seldom that we ever see the price. I never can remember a price ever coming down. The only thing that'll ever happen is they'll stabilize at a price point for a period of 2-3 years. But I can't, the only time you ever get anything on the cheap is because someone needs to unload it quickly. And that really typically doesn't happen, because good tobacco, if treated well, is a commodity kind of product, and it just doesn't tend to devalue itself. So it's probably the biggest challenge I think we have on the manufacturing cycle. Yeah, we have a slight advantage on the labor costs in Nicaragua compared to the Dominican, probably
not anymore.
Not as much. But the tobacco is what's driving the cost. There's no doubt about it.
But Saka, you mentioned the Angelica farm as an example. Having a locked in kind of commission on a specific, we used to do that as well in Jalapa. And the problem is that's beneficial in some years, but if that one guy has a bad year, now you're scrambling. So you really kind of have right. to, you have to spread out your,
What you have to do is you have to try to build in the risk factor. So like, right. I use a lot of the Angelica. So ultimately I have far more of it than I really need. And right. I will continue to supplement as time allows, because I know there's going to be a year where it gets really bad. But if, for example, those sin compromiso sales quadruple, well, then no, there's no way that I can ever meet the demand, because I only have so much of that particular tobacco ready to go. There's definitely always a top end limit, but the problem is it's become much more difficult. And look, we talked about this when I was with you. I mean, Cameroon is a terribly difficult tobacco to source. You have years where there's more of it. You have years of it where there's less of it. You always are dealing with leaves that are initially, they start off shorter. It's almost impossible to make Churchill size, you know, 6x60s. You know, even Toros can be a problem in Cameroon. It's a problematic leaf from a length point of view, you know, on the table. Certain tobaccos like, you know, Pennsylvania seed leaf, there's a lot of Pennsylvania seed leaf out there, but the question is how much of it is actually wrapper quality versus, you know, being used as a good Lajero replacement in a blend. You know, Connecticut broadleaf, one of the things we always struggle with at Drew Estate is on number nines, we always want to use number one darks. Well, you have seasons where there are no number one darks. If you don't have a particularly dry, hot season, you get no number one darks off the plant. You just get a lot of mediums. You know, so, and part of it too is trying to, one of the things that I always try to think about when I'm making a brand is what are some of the more sustainable choices? So like in Mikkei Rita, I chose to use broadleaf mediums rather than use number one darks.
Yeah, but that's
– there's better availability of mediums than there ever is of number one darks.
Right, and that's part of the blending process that people don't a lot of times talk about. But so here the kind of net of it, and Hector can probably tell you the same thing from Lozona. They have the same challenges, I'm sure. But the bottom line is if you're a guy who – like Steve transformed the factory that he gets cigars made in, a lot of his cigars made in.
Well, that's not true. I was part of the trend.
But that's what I mean is you committing to go there gave them a scale of super premiums that allowed them to justify making a lot of the changes that they made.
Yes.
And so you have a different kind of relationship with that factory and with Gus. But if you're a guy who kind of flies down for 10 days, you know, every 3 or 4 months and has the company make your cigars for you, unless they're just making derivative things from their own tobacco, which doesn't necessarily mean that it's a bad cigar, you have a risk of in the next year or two not being able to get sustainable core lines out of contract manufacturing.
Well, that's why I've always said when it comes to many of the small brand owners, that's the reason why the products are inconsistent, because you are working off – you're working at the – you're serving at the pleasure of the factory to a degree.
Right.
And you don't have the ability to control that. And the thing is, even when you do have the ability to control it, it still is sometimes just simply beyond your control. There are a lot of factors in this business that have always made it a very difficult business. I mean, look, we know of a very big, long established factory in Nicaragua that had to shut down for 2 weeks because they ran out of wrapper. I mean, that's unreal.
Or every day you hear about the big factories that put their people on kind of constrained production, right? So yeah. instead of allowing them to make the normal 250, 300 cigar, 400 cigars a day that they make 150 and they go home. So, but you know, the one thing, and I don't, unless Hector has something to add to this piece of it, is the other things that are driving price. You know, what started the kind of trouble last April was this issue over Ents. Well, in January, they increased our Ents contribution. They tripled our income tax rate, essentially. And there's an inflation in everything right now in Nicaragua. Some things have gone up 70-80%, like basic things. So our workers that used to take home X now had the buying power of, you know, 65% of X with the same salary. So in January, we did our normal cost of living kind of increases for everyone. And we had to do an additional cost of living increase for everyone with a bonus payment just because there's so much economic struggle in terms of the general economy. So if to the extent that we buy things in Nicaragua, everything we buy in Nicaragua, whether it's cellophane or bands from Sancho at Cigar Rings or boxes, everything has gone up by a significant amount.
Yes.
Also, to add to what Skip's saying, not only has everything gone up, and just outside of cigars, the commodity situation in Nicaragua is poor right now. You have people, we've met people who work outside of the cigar industry, in the food industry, in the supermarket industry. They're not allowed to sell, make big sales because they're not sure when they're going to be able to replenish their inventories of canned goods, of dry goods. And I think Skip made the point earlier. I don't know if there are more players now, but there are bigger players involved. I mean, now, you know, smaller fish have to deal with these big fish, and the big fish are hungrier than ever, don't you think, Skip?
Well, I mean, I heard it, you know, last year they made a big deal about, you know, kind of bashing Nicaragua from the Dominican side because of the surge Nicaragua's had over the last 4 or 5 years. But there's a lot of Dominican cigar makers in Nicaragua all the time buying tobacco. So, it's a challenging thing, which which I think we as a company manage really well, all things considered. But it's, you know, it's not like making widgets where every day all you have to worry about is selling them. I'm far, far, far more concerned about making things and my ability to make things and how we make things than I am about whether we're going to be able to sell them or not.
It's tough. I mean, it to the point that we developed this relationship with AJ just because of the convenience of being able to do some of the lines that we, some of our predicate stuff that that we were using Mexican, we're using broadleaf. It was just easier to get the cigar done there,
right,
than to buy the broadleaf, bring it in, you know, have to have me having to task the guys at our factory, but having to try to go find it. It was just easier. And we're very blessed.
Is that working for you? I mean, I know
it's, it has. Eric's relationship with AJ has been good. There hasn't been any, we haven't had to raise prices or we're in guaranteed production. I mean, you know, it's what we had to do. It was in the perfect world, you would like to be able to source everything and do everything yourself, but we just didn't find ourselves in that situation. And it was easier. It was less work for our factory to put the guys in our factory who run our factory to have to try to source tobacco that, you know, that they weren't comfortable with at the beginning. They didn't know. The two guys who run our factory, when they first came to Nicaragua, they lived under the Cuban tobacco is the best tobacco in the world. Then after working here a year, 2 years, Nicaraguan tobacco is now the best tobacco. Every time you tried to introduce any tobacco, you weren't met with a problem, but you were, they weren't completely on board.
That's true of all workers in all factories. It's a rare item for any torcedor to want any change. In their perfect world, they get to make the same cigar with the same tobacco every day. That's what they want. And so you're always going to have that kind of just general resistance at a workforce level, you know, because for them, a lot of what they do is muffle memory. And you start working with something like Arapiaca that's so hydroscopic, it holds so much water, it stretches different on the table, you know, just the way it goes on a cigar feels much different than how a broadleaf goes on a cigar. The way you have to deal with the veins of the Pennsylvania seed leaf is far different than how you have to deal with it in the other Maduro tobaccos. So
it's funny you say that. When I was just at the factory a week ago, 2 weeks ago, one of the rollers looks at me and she goes, "I really love this wrapper. I've never worked with this before."
Yeah.
And, you know, but I don't like the veins.
Yeah.
You know, what do you want me to do? It's a different tobacco. You know, it was a Pennsylvania seed leaf. You know, at least they're paying attention. You know, they know they're not working with the same wrapper.
The way you do with a Pennsylvania seed leaf on the table, the way you do your cuts are different on the seed leaf than the way you do your cuts on the broad leaf. It changes everything you do, you know. In seed leaf, it's very easy to make a lot of large cigars because of the length of the wrapper. It's very hard to get more than just a single cigar out of a side unless you're taking that long, skinny side and breaking it into two shorter cigars. But then you have a problem with consistency because the tips of any tobacco is always stronger than the butt of any tobacco. So if you end up using the back half on one and the front half on the front end, lower end on the other, sure, then you have to be cognizant of, okay, I'm going to split this leaf in two, but I've got to make sure that all the fronts go on this particular vitola and all the back butt ends go on this particular vitola so that it ends up having some consistency.
Well, that's what we do with Weaselito. So we have thousands of these, Tabacchiato Lanceros already ready to go. And then every day we bring those and you'll have a pair that's working on, for example, Neanderthal HNs and they'll make the cut for the Neanderthal HN. They'll take the cigar out of the mold, wrap that cigar. And then before they take the other part of the tobacco off the table, they then do a Weaselito.
Right.
Right. So exactly what you're saying, you have to do two completely different cigars with the second cut.
Right.
You know, but it's funny when we first got some of that Pennsylvania broadleaf, that wrapper, my two guys are from Cuba. They're Cuban guys. And he holds the leaf up and he goes, you know how many cigars I could make out of this in Cuba?
right. It's like,
you know how many cigars I can make out of this in Cuba?
Right.
But then, of course, then he goes, but this is bullshit. The best rapper in the world is from Cuba. Then I walk away. I got to walk away at that point of the conversation.
But that's one of the interesting things, too, about our factory, as you guys know, is that, you know, we have, like, you know, a pair that today is rolling HNs. You know, tomorrow in the afternoon, they're doing the finishing touches on a craft, and then tomorrow they're rolling Arapiraca. And, you know, that's why we can't lose people. That's why we have the same 24 people making cigars that we've had, you know, since for a long time.
Skip all knows I'm on the opposite end of the spectrum. I try to keep people on near the same size, the same blend every single day.
Yeah, but when you have 120 pairs in a factory, you can do that. When you have 12 pairs, it's a different story.
No, I agree. Look, it's definitely a different thing. But I think universally, though, we all have the same tobacco challenges. We all have the same price challenges. I think that, and as you well know, Skip, I mean, we don't know where these taxes are going to end up. They're not done.
No, it changes just today, this morning. I came in the factory to do a quick 15-minute thing before I headed to go do something else. And, you know, Doris, our admin, comes and she goes, hey, I got this new letter from Mafik. They're changing this process. I'm like, well, didn't they change it just 2 weeks ago? She goes, yeah, but they're changing it again.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's like every day there's something new coming from them about just ridiculous stuff. And being small, and, you know, we can kind of adjust and move and do the things we got to do. But, you know, if you're a bigger company, man, you got to change the whole direction of the fucking super tanker. Sometimes these little changes come out. Like the inch takes
11 miles to stop a super tanker.
Right. The inch change in January for us meant that instead of paying, you know, $8,000 a month in ints, we pay $11,000 a month in ints, or $12,000 a month in ints. For someone like AJ or Drew Estate, they went from paying $80,000 a month to paying $120,000 a month.
Yeah, right? More than that, actually.
Or whatever. And it's not a small amount.
No, it's very large. And the thing is, you know, like the conversation I was having earlier about the whole price increase thing, consumers are just going to have to decide whether there's a value in it for them, because ultimately, and look, the cigars have to have a certain level of profit in order for them to be sustainable and consistent. And as the prices continue to drive up, and there's just no way to avoid these, because the truth is, like I said before, we all wish that it would stop, because it's been crazy. It's been crazy tobacco wise for the last 3-4 years, but now with these taxes is coming into play and the uncertainty of the other taxes that they're discussing, it's making the situation very rough right now for Nicaragua.
Yeah. And so Coop, one of the things that I think we're really kind of fortunate in is that, you know, we're already making super, super premium cigars at $8. So we have a little bit of room before we start butting up against, you know, the $10, $11, $12 mark that a lot of our competitors are at, because of our model. But if you're already one of these guys that's contract manufacturing with a factory, you're probably already overpaying $1 a cigar coming out of the factory, and then you're, you know, paying someone else to sell it. You know, if you're already at $10, $11, $12 and you're one of these kind of guys that's already struggling, you'll start seeing a lot of these guys just fall out, because you can't make it.
But you're already seeing them fall out.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many of these smaller brands that, I mean, they haven't officially gone out of business, but for all practical purposes, you don't see the cigars in the store. You don't see the buzz by the consumers. So even though they haven't announced they're out of business, they effectively are out of business. And I mean, look, and the thing is, it always comes back to the same thing. Consumers have to make a decision as to whether, hey, am I happy with the $8 I spent? Am I happy with the $11 I spent? Am I happy with the $22 I spent? It always becomes a value question to each individual consumer. But as a general rule, I think consumers should expect Nicaraguan cigar prices to continue to escalate in cost. I don't see that changing in the near term.
Or quality, or look for quality go down.
And we really can't take that risk.
Yeah.
We can't.
No, but I'm saying some people will make that decision, right? Some people who've been using, you know, a Lajero will switch over to a Viso. Some people that have been using, you know, kind of the top, you know, the X type of wrapper will start accepting lower primings of that wrapper or whatever. And right. And but consumers,
that's always what happens. And
right, right.
And then it just depends on whether the consumers decide it's worth their money. This is, look, I always say, I mean, these brands that are machine-made brands today, brands like Antonio and Cleopatra, that used to be a handmade clear Havana cigar out of Florida. Just over the years, it degraded into the product that it is today. But that used to be a handmade premium cigar out of Cuban tobacco with an American Connecticut shade or a Candela wrapper on it.
You know, right.
That is what happens if you try to constantly hold the price point. And the thing is, you can do these minor changes and you can get away with them, but that cigar will not be the cigar year to year. And within 5 to 10 years, it will be noticeably not the same cigar.
Well, you know? Right.
You can't hide under, you know, you can get away with this little cut to make it this year, but those cuts accumulate. And eventually, right, you end up with a lesser version of a brand, of a product. And you just have to say, you know, what's more important to you? Is the sales volume more important to you, or are your consumers willing to spend another 25 cents, 50 cents at the retail register to get the same thing that they've gotten in the past?
When you said earlier, when you guys asked earlier about what the media could do, I don't think there's enough stories where the media has covered this aspect of what manufacturers are going through, the smaller manufacturers especially. This is something that consumers don't know.
The larger manufacturers are going through it, and they've actually been, the smaller manufacturers have actually been the ones that have been the most reluctant to raise prices. And the larger manufacturers, they've been very steady over the years to pretty much issue their 3 to 5% price increase like clockwork, and some of them have done it as much as twice in any given year.
No, but my point is to let, you know, they're asking earlier, they asked about what the media could do, what other things they could cover at the show. Maybe not at the show, but this is a story that needs to be told. I have a shop that I sit at, and it's my shop. I go to Caribbean, I go 4 or 5 times a week. And you hear the comment, man, this has gone up 75 cents since it came out. Well, you know, tobacco's gone up. And I know I use a very simple story, but somewhere there's a tobacco farmer who got on a plane. And while he was waiting to get on a plane, he walked by a magazine stand and he picked up a Cigar Aficionado. And he saw that there was a cigar selling for $20 and he sells a pound of tobacco for $4. You know, how is that possible that a cigar costs $20 and I'm selling a pound of the tobacco in this filler for $4? His price goes up. And it's a chain. It goes all the way down the road.
Yeah, well, you know, another thing on this coupe is, so like this year we had a production plan to make 230,000 Cro-Magnon broadleaf cigars. Generally, the way we would have done that is we would have made, 65,000 a quarter, and that way we would have had this continuous supply. We would have these huge back orders the whole year, and they would have been what it is. This year, because we were waiting on Atapuraca, which took a little bit longer because of the humidity, And then also we were waiting on the Habano. We had the production capacity to make all 230,000 of those cigars between October and February. So when we got to the end of May, we sold the last Cro-Magnon we had in the Escaparate. It was already sold back in October, but we shipped the last Cro-Magnon we had. And then we told everybody, there's no more Cro-Magnon for the rest of this year. And I could go out tomorrow with Esteban and we could buy 3 packs of broadleaf from here, 6 from here, and we could make substandard Cro-Magnons for the whole rest of the year if that's what we wanted to do. But if we did that, then it would kill the brand. And on the flip side of that, I could fill all my production capacity, all 1 million cigars, 25,000 cigars a week. I could make nothing but Neanderthals and I could sell all million of them. So I just fill that capacity with other cigars that are going to sell. And then some people are going to look at it and go, well, Skip doesn't know what he's doing because he's not making Cro-Magnon for the rest of the year. You know, fuck that guy. I'm like, look,
trademark.
You know, I'm really good at production planning. I don't have to argue with anybody about that, but I'm not going to make substandard cigars. So if you aren't happy with that, then, you know, there's plenty of, you know, cigars sitting in a warehouse somewhere that, you know, other companies want to sell you for 25% off. Go buy those.
Fair enough. By the way, we had some really good feedback in the chat room on this conversation. So it definitely resonated with our audience. So thank you. We're definitely past the witching hour for, I know, a couple of you guys. So we're going to skip our last segment, which is our Alec Bradley Live True segment. And I'll just mention our sponsor, Alec Bradley, Alec Bradley, Alec Bradley, Alec Bradley, Alec Bradley. Visit alecbradley.com to find out more about their cigars. Live True. So we won't do a segment, but I'll just say, as part of IPCPR, we have the media compound. We definitely want you guys coming out to the media compound this year if you all want to come together.
Do you have a mister? Because me and Steve almost died last year out there.
There's a pool. There's a pool, so you can hop in if you want.
Yeah, take your bathing suits. Take your bathing suits.
Think about what you're asking. You want me and Steve to go thong in the pool. Are you sure?
Hey, whatever you want, man.
I can't swim, so I'm okay.
No, don't worry. I saw
one of those icy packs for my balls this year.
Yeah, no. So
I definitely saw Seth sent me a picture with his lifeguard shirt,
yep,
and his lover boy headband.
That's the first lover boy reference I've heard in years.
Yeah, well, you know, the first thing I thought, I said, you look like the guy from Loverboy. And he told me not to hate.
Yeah, but Mike Reno, man, he just went down the toilet. Have you ever seen? He's a disaster.
He's 65 years old, bro. What do you want? You know, you want a piece of my heart? Come on, what do you want from that guy, bro? Yeah, Seth had me crazy doing the photos.
No, that's good.
But yeah, that compound, the compound was fun. It was great to be out there, but man, it was hotter than.
I went to bed. Sokka was still there, I think, till 4 a.m. one night.
It was hotter than a witch's cooch out there, man. It was hot, bro. I'm telling you.
Yeah. So no, we'll always have the indoor piece of the compound as well, which will be fully air conditioned.
Non smoking.
All right.
Non smoking, yes.
Non smoking, but we'll
not
figure
out. Going in there.
I'm going in there. Fuck that.
Fuck that shit. Fuck that guy.
You can smoke in the pool. So.
Yeah. And
I don't know. This sounds like somebody might be catching another rape charge.
and are we gonna have shellfish?
Chili with a lover boy outfit.
We'll have shellfish there, maybe.
Yeah.
It was hot, man. It was hot. I think there's a picture. There's a picture of us. There's a picture of us at a picnic table, and both of our shirts are darker. The sleeves are lighter than the shirt. We were sweated through that. It was hot as hell.
It was the heat of the but then one night we had that wind come. I don't know if you guys were there.
We had a storm that came through.
Yeah, we had a storm that came through, which was actually pretty cool for a while. All right. So I'm just going to, before I close it out, thank our guests. Just next week, show 100. No guests. It's just Aaron and I. We will be going, doing the big board show where we go down the list of the companies and the releases. That kind of started last year as a last minute substitution for a guest that canceled at the last minute. And we ended up actually, people were asking back for that show. So we'll be going through all that next week for show 100, which looks like we're going to make it. So
when's the blooper show? Do you have a blooper show coming?
You know, that's something I was actually talking about. I keep pulling a montage together of stuff. So
a lot of material for that.
Yeah.
definitely. Some good moments there. So, guys, I want to thank you guys again. I know it's late for everyone. I know, Skip, you had a long day as well. So thank you guys very, very much. We do appreciate it. Looking forward to seeing you guys in Las Vegas in a couple weeks. Anyway, Aaron, anything else?
I think that's it.
All right. That's going to wrap up Primetime Episode 99 into the Annals of History for Thursday, June 13th. Now Friday, June 14th on the
right coast.
Skip, it's Donald Trump's birthday, by the way, so I know you want to wish him a happy birthday. So
happy birthday, Mr. President.
All right. Anyway, have a great night, everybody. Thanks to our audience who really stuck in there late. So we do appreciate our audience as well and all the great conversation. We'll see everybody next week. Have a great one, everyone.
See you guys.